G.I. Joe Tomahawk.
Look, come in a second, you heartbreaker. Tomahawk to the rescue.
Tomahawk holds 8 Joes and it's loaded for battle.
No, Joe!
Tomahawk's gonna chase some cobras. Tomahawk is on the go. Tomahawk's gonna chase some cobras and rescue G.I. Joe. G.I. Joe.
Live the adventure of G.I. Joe. G.I. Joe Tomahawk. Other Joe and Cobra figures sold separately.
No, Joe!
Here's Big Jim, his safari outfit, his camping tent, and friend Big Josh. Big Jim's on safari when suddenly he sees Big Josh coming at him through the trees. Big Jim says, let's see if he's stronger than me. Big Josh cracks this tree stump with his axe. Big Jim splits this board with karate wax. And they realize when the contest ends, the two strong guys are going to be strong friends. Big Jim, Big Josh, camping tent, and safari outfit all sold separately from Mattel.
Hello, hello.
Good morning.
Morning.
How are you?
Pretty good. It's later in the day. I'm in the future compared to you. The future's all right.
Yeah, you're at 11:30.
Yes.
It's still prior to the afternoon, though.
Yes, so it's still...
It's brunch.
Technically brunch, yeah. They get in right on the cusp of regular lunch.
Yeah.
This is Geek Brunch Retrocast episode 4.
Yes, it is.
And I didn't figure out who I am today.
So and I am, let's see, who am I? I am Angelo Martali, one of your hosts.
Ah, I guess I am Danny Rand.
I know who that is. Do you know who I am?
I don't think so.
Yeah, well, you'll find out.
All right. There you go. That gives us a suspense.
Yeah, ba-dum-bum. If I lose control of my mouse during the podcast, it's because Harley got a hold of it. It's got bite marks at the top and then the side. But she didn't do too much damage. They're just punctured like where she was carrying it around in her mouth.
Oh, so it's a wireless.
Yeah.
Nice. Yeah, it's like, I guess that would be a perfect size for a toy for a dog her size.
Yeah. She's got plenty of her own toys. And if you hear squeaking during the podcast, that's because she's got the squeak thing. She runs around the house squeaking her toys. I can't control
Is that the little Joker one?
No, well, she's got a Joker now. She's got an alligator. She's got a duck and a monkey.
Ah, nice.
And the monkey's got the little squeakers in the feet and the arms. And she's figured that out now, so she's just chews on them and it squeaks
nice.
Over and over again.
Luna's gotten too old to care about toys, really.
Yeah.
She still has a basket of them, and Kara said... She still has this one that's called Miss Squirrel. And I guess that was her favorite one back in the day when she was younger. And every day Kara get home from work, she would greet her at the door holding Miss Squirrel in her mouth. Like, you know, she killed it for her as a present. And she, I guess, yeah, it squeaks, so she'd walk around squeaking it all the time.
Yeah.
So.
Now it's all food and sleep, huh?
Yeah, pretty much.
Walking.
She gets a little... This is the best time of year for her because she likes the cold. Kara used to think she was told that she was mostly German Shepherd, but we found out by a really experienced vet that she's still a mix, but she's mostly Husky. So that kind of explains why she's such a big fan of the cold and snow.
Yeah.
Because she loves the snow and she'll just dig her whole face down into a snowbank and that gets her going a little bit still. She had a little pep in her step after that.
Yeah, Harley likes the snow too. We haven't had much though. Global warming.
Yeah. But it's raining and overcast here today, but it's supposed to be around 50.
This is Colorado Springs, and we're usually getting snow. I don't think we've had any snowfall in November, and we've been having like 56 degree averages. you know?
Yeah.
We've only had one day. T-shirts.
Yeah. We had one day of snow, and it was actually last Sunday afternoon. It snowed for a little while, and I went out and shoveled the driveway a little bit, but that's only really... We had some flurries on Friday that before it warmed up, but nothing that stuck to the ground or anything. So, really, anymore, it seems like January and February are the real bad months, February especially.
Yeah.
But I am all ready to talk some comics. I got my free comic book t-shirt on. I got water and coffee and typed notes and written notes and my cat sleeping on the futon behind me. He's my comic reading partner, because a lot of times when I'm laying in bed reading comics at night,
yeah,
he loves to lay on top of me, so he'll come creeping up and he'll want to lay right in front of my face and I have to push him back. So it'll be just a comic book right in front of, like, it's basically in between our faces. So he's a connoisseur of comic book covers.
Yeah.
Back covers, because that's mostly what he gets to read.
Yeah, Scooter used to love to read comics. He used to fall asleep on piles of them.
They do funny. Yeah, I had one of the drawers in my comic book drawers out. I was doing something with them, and so it left, you know, the open square. And next thing I knew, he was up inside the square. All I could see was his tail sticking out. And I was laughing. I'm like, I showed Kara. She's like, "That's funny, but you might want to get him out of there, because that probably reminds him of his litter box."
Yeah.
Like, oh, shit, yeah, you're right.
Yeah, it's funny until something happens.
Yeah, yeah, it's funny until one of them pukes or takes a leak on one of my comics.
When Scooter got older, he used to love for me to go up into the upper bedroom and sort comics. He would just love that. He'd go, like, lay down in there and watch me do it the whole day.
Nice. He probably liked that you were sticking in one place and have to follow you around.
Yeah.
So. So I saw you asking for some feedback on Twitter. Did you get any responses?
I got feedback, but I haven't gotten any, like, questions or anything.
Yeah.
There's a couple of people that wanted to know where, how to get it, and then a couple. There was one, Reed, who's, I think, been listening to Geek Brunch since the dawn of time, if I remember correctly. Matter of fact, he was like the first person or listener I ever met that recognized me by voice at a convention. Cool. Yeah, when I was at HeroesCon the very first time.
Nice.
He introduced himself. But he's always participated in, we used to have the Geek Brunch Secret Santa, and he was always part of that.
That's cool. Yeah, I think we follow each other on Twitter.
Yeah.
I believe. I don't know who you're talking about. So
I see him at Heroes every year, and we chat.
Do you look at download numbers for your shows? Do you have a sense of how people listen to different shows you do?
I used to get them from Derek a lot, but he stopped sending them for whatever reason, so... But I can tell that we do pretty good, because if you look at, like, what's hot, you know, like, go to the podcast and what's hot,
mm-hmm.
usually at night and in the mornings, Geek Brunch is in there. So
that's cool.
It's like the top 120 podcasts, so it's usually, that's pretty good, because there's a lot of podcasts.
Yeah. Yeah, I was just curious. I don't have a real sense of that kind of thing. And I know it's funny, I find myself, I sort of think of, it's interesting to me how your podcasts reflect different, the times that they are recorded almost. Like, I think like DC Noise is almost like Mike Myers After Dark, you know?
Yeah.
And this, I feel like this show kind of, and the regular Geek Brunch kind of represents the early Sunday recording time. It's like kind of mellow. And I think, I mean, I have listened back to the ones that we've done. I can see why Keith was falling asleep because I think I sound pretty mellow.
Well, the last episode of DC Noise, he was like death quiet. No, it was the one with the Timmy Thum on it. We were talking comics and you wouldn't hear him. But then you mention a fart or something and he's back in the conversation. It's like, what?
Yeah. Did you guys record last night? Or?
No, we didn't.
Okay.
I had an extra one in the can. On that show, we record two every time we record. And right. I had released the Eric Martin tribute episode, so I had one more episode left.
Right. Yeah, that's... I thought maybe you did it because I didn't see the usual aftermath on social networks. There's usually some kind of evidence of weird comments on Facebook or
Twitter. Something that happened. Yeah.
Yeah, or you know, new eBay auctions from Keith or something.
Yeah, we're crawling up on 200 too, so we're gonna have a couple of guests on.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah,
getting there. Yeah, speaking of retro, actually, I listened to some retro Mike Myers a couple weeks ago. some early Geek Brunch
with Heath. That early?
Yeah. Yeah, I listened to some Heath and like around when you started having guests on the show.
Yeah.
I've listened to some old DC Noise too, just because I mean I wasn't listening. Speaking of Eric, I wasn't listening when he was on the show, so yeah. I've gone back and checked out some episodes with him and stuff, but because when I listened, I started listening to DC Noise right when it was just a little bit before Daryl started coming on the show.
Yeah.
When he guested a few times in between episodes with just you and Keith, and then then he started coming on regularly. But one thing that's funny is I did actually go back and find, speaking of, you know, Keith talking about me as a podcasting babe.
You went and listened to his first one or what?
I went and listened to his first one. It's like, oh, thank you for this opportunity, Mike. It's really good to talk to you.
It's all professional.
So, yeah. I mean, you know, it's just funny. I think that's true for everybody, you know?
Yeah, it's weird looking at all the people we've had on Geek Brunch through the years, and now how we're a lot more closer than we were, most of us. Some have drifted apart, like Heath I don't talk to a lot, but he's just recently back on Facebook. He's got a cool like Western beard or Western mustache. I'd like to talk to him and get him back on the show just to see what he's up to.
Yeah, that'd be cool, even if he only did it once, just to kind of touch base or reconnect with you, you know?
Yeah.
But, so what do you want to start with this week? Did you want to go back to starting with Kirby or random stuff? Or
I'll leave it up to you this time. I decided last time. What do you want to start with?
I guess we could flip back, keep rotating. We could start with Kirby this time, and
okay,
just keep flipping it around or something. Because I was actually just doing my I read them. I had to refamiliarize because I read them last weekend, so I was doing some of my notes this morning, just jotting down a few things, and also sort of the purpose of me flipping back through and reminding myself of what went on and all that. It's pretty easy to forget.
Yeah, I recently went to look at why people hate Vince Coletta so much.
And, yeah, I saw you asked Tom Scioli about that, right?
Yeah, I did. And his answer was pretty much, I guess, standard fare, is that Vince did a lot of freaking work.
Yeah.
And in order to get his inks done, he took a lot of shortcuts. And the shortcuts is what led to his I guess, hate in the community, or not hate, but I don't want to work with him because he's deleting shit that I drew, kind of thing. So sometimes, like, they would draw a lot of the background and he'd erase it so he didn't have to ink it. You know what I mean? So, but he was a monster as far as how much he would get done. I mean, and maybe that's why he did take shortcuts. But I would think, and I can't go back in time and I can't be a fly on the wall, but I would think at the time that DC was doing the Kirby verse, I would think that Kirby had total control. Like, in other words, they were like, welcome to DC, you're doing whatever you want with this fourth world stuff. And I think he could have, if he was not liking what Vince was doing to his work, I think he could have just said, nah, I ain't working out. And I think eventually he did change inkers, but I don't know if it was for that reason. It would be very interesting to see, like, I haven't seen a lot of the original Kirby pages. Like, I don't subscribe to the Tomorrows. We've talked about them in the past, but they have, like, that Kirby magazine.
Yeah.
And I haven't seen a lot of original Kirby art to know, like, what did that page look like? But I would love to compare, you know.
Yeah, that would be interesting for sure. I came across, Mark Evanier, if that's how you say it, the guy that has written, he worked with Kirby and he has written a lot about Kirby and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
He said that Kirby's contract with DC was actually for 15 pages a week.
Wow.
That's insane. I wonder if he even had time to pay attention to what the inks were. Like, it just seems insane to me. And I don't know if he was used to working that, doing that much in a given week, when he left Marvel and came over, and that's why he was comfortable with that contract, or if DC insisted on that level of output. But I mean, it explains how he was doing so many books at one time. And if Vince Coletta was inking all of that, it's kind of hard to, I feel like it seems a little unfair to blame him for taking shortcuts if you're
doing that much work.
That much. I mean, so there's artists that can't do that many pages in a month.
Yeah, and I also read somewhere, I can't remember where I read it, but when there's some fans, like Tom Scholey said that he really liked the inker that came after Vince Coletta, but what he did appreciate from Vince Coletta was he had brought that Marvel style over. So so he really liked that. And but now that I want to go look at what the difference is, like where that other inker entered in, and see if I can see differences. Now that I know, I'll be looking for it. You know what I mean? Whereas if I was just reading it, I wouldn't be looking probably in detail.
Yeah, I don't think... Do you know if Vince Coletta inked... I don't think he inked OMAC, did he?
I do not remember, but I can find out, like, really fast.
Yeah, because I think that was a different inker, so that might be an interesting sample since it's sort of the same time.
OMAC is my favorite, obviously.
Yeah.
There's only 8 issues, but... it was Mike Royer, so it is the guy that... Tom Scholey mentioned, at least on the first few issues.
Mm-hmm.
And then it was a guy called Bruce Berry. So.
Okay. Yeah. So that's interesting. But yeah, it's always interesting to look back. The farther you get back, the 70s it's still long enough ago that there's some significant differences in how, the industry was. I mean, the 80s changed a lot of stuff, but it wasn't the same kind of atmosphere that you have today where everybody's getting their art back and, you're seeing a signature down the bottom of splash pages because everybody knows they're going to sell their art and use that as a second source of income. And, things are a little more cutthroat, I think, in some regards. So, It's interesting to go back, and now the stuff that has aged well and has survived and people like Kirby's stuff, you know, he worked through so many changes in the comic industry. It's interesting to go back now that people are appreciating it and collecting all this stuff and making sure it's preserved for the future. The conditions and the circumstances surrounding his work were a lot different than they are today, and they were even different probably from the beginning of his career to the end, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So.
I would like to get Tom on if we can.
Yeah,
I don't know if you know, but I'm a huge Tom fan. I don't have a lot of, like, a lot of sketches compared mm-hmm. to a lot of congoers, but I do have at least 12 or 13 pieces of Tom Scholey art that I've gathered over the years. So he's awesome. The one artist that I've followed.
Yeah, I haven't really collected any art or sketches yet, but I'd like to get a little bit of stuff eventually just to hang up and stuff, and he'd be a cool one to get something from, because I probably discovered him through you talking about him, some other podcasters. The only thing I've really read of his is American Barbarian, which...
So wonderful.
God. Yeah, which, I mean, it was an awesome start. I really loved it. I read it super fast. I got the hardcover.
But do you see the comparison? Like, it's so Kirby-esque that not in terms of storytelling and art, you know, that it's...
Yeah.
It's wonderful.
Yeah, well, a thing I like about it, though, is, I mean, there's an obvious... The influence there is obvious, I would say, but I feel like he has the creative mind. You know, if it was just somebody directly copying or imitating Kirby...
Oh, he's doing his own thing.
Yeah, like, one of the things about Kirby is, you know, his imagination was so wild, and it seems like Tom Scioli has, you know, an equivalent of that in terms of coming up with really, really wild concepts. And I appreciate that because, you know, I think it takes advantage the way that Kirby did of stuff that you could only really do in comic books.
Yeah. Yeah. I can't even believe, though, like, how far my OMAC love has gone, because that one year that we went to meet at Heroes Con from Geek Brunch, in the video I even have an OMAC sketch from Tom Scioli.
Nice.
Yeah, I was like, wow, I've been obsessed with OMAC for a long time.
I will definitely in the future be checking out some, you know, next time I can pick up a bunch of trades, at some point I want to get all the Godland stuff and definitely check out more of his stuff.
Yeah, he's amazing. I like him. I like to talk to him. He's the one guy that, like, I like to watch sketch because he's, like, really fast. Like, you could just sit there for a while and check it out. Harley just saw a cat.
Oh, boy. We got a couple cats on the street that are outdoor cats. Sometimes they stalk me and Luna when we're walking.
She seems really friendly towards cats. Like, it's weird because, like, we'll take her to the pet and she just sniffs them because they're in their cages, you know, to be adopted.
Mm-hmm.
But they'll usually attack her. They, like, you know. And yeah. Then she, like, leaves them alone after that.
It's like, whoa, what the hell? What's your problem? Yeah, I think a lot of it comes down to size, you know.
Uh-huh.
The cats, they want to... We crack up at our cat because we can tell he's trying to, you know... He doesn't have his own water dish because he won't drink out of it. He insists on sneaking up and drinking out of Luna's dish. So he'll literally be stocking up and he'll look around, see if she's anywhere nearby, and then he'll start drinking out of her water.
Yeah.
That's the only way he'll drink water is by stealing it from her. You know, and he's always sitting on her beds and things like that. So it really seems like he's trying to be the social climber, you know?
Yeah.
And she's just like, thinks he's like a little runt, you know, doesn't care. So it cracks me up. But so, well, did you have a favorite this week out of these three?
In terms of laughing, I learned a lot about hippies and forever people. So that was that had a lot of entertainment value.
I think that was my favorite.
I think in terms of plot, I still am enjoying Superman's Pal as far as the story, because there's just so much happening there.
Mm-hmm.
And in terms of, I guess I like them all in different terms.
Yeah. Yeah. Me too.
I really enjoyed the art in the New Gods.
Mm-hmm.
The art and the design in New Gods is awesome.
Yeah. Yeah, that's definitely one of the things that really appealing. I gotta love all that Kirby tech, and it's not you can tell he's creating some of this stuff just out of his imagination. There's no reference he could have had for it.
Yeah,
because the stuff just doesn't exist, you know. But yeah, Forever People was too much. I mean, that was hilarious. But I can see what you're saying about Jimmy Olsen, because it feels like, because we were doing this, it feels like such a long time since we last read it. So to get the continuation, to finally see the battle between Big Green Jimmy and the Guardian, you know?
Yeah.
So should we jump into that one then? That's
sure.
The first one.
That's Jimmy Olsen's Pal, or Superman's Pal. or you could say Jimmy Olsen's Pal Superman, I guess.
Sure, yeah.
136.
I did notice that this is one of the covers that Neil Adams did.
Yeah.
So you did a few of them.
You can kind of tell on the Superman.
Mm-hmm.
The Jimmy Olsen, maybe not so much, but the Superman face definitely looks like a Neil Adams.
Yeah, I think there's enough of a difference between their styles. It's not a shocking, glaring difference, but yeah, it's noticeable, though, I think.
It's definitely noticeable if you read a Neil Adams Batman comic or something. There's a lot of difference.
Yeah.
A drawn, sequential art style.
Right,
In Green Arrow and, Green Lantern, or in some of his detective comics or Batman.
Yeah, if you look at a bigger sample of his stuff, yeah, that makes sense.
He was like the Todd McFarlane of that time period, I think. Because I think as some styles were much appreciated, like Jack Kirby's, I think when Neil Adams came, it was like, oh, there's a new generation of artists now. And then artists start to mimic his style, which is a little more anatomically correct.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, a little more realistic and
mm-hmm.
Musculature is not as exaggerated. So, I mean, the cover here, Superman doesn't look, he looks like a human that's kind of built,
Yeah, he's getting punched in the face.
Yeah, Superman continues his habit of being knocked out or out of commission or something when we start, we got, like I said, it starts out with the battle that was about to begin at the end of the last issue of Jimmy Olsen with the Golden Guardian and the giant green Jimmy Olsen that Makari and Simeon sent over to the labs, and Superman's passed out nearby. And we get quite a few pages, really.
A good splash page.
Yeah, nice double page splash. Right. Yeah.
Is it you that tweeted that link that gave all of the Kirby double page splashes, or?
I found someone tweeted a link to it, but the link was kind of weird, and I followed it and then just tweeted directly off of the Flickr page. But Yeah, I'd seen that before and forgot about it. It's really awesome just to flip through. It's one thing I think. Sometimes when it comes to modern comics, I think because I just recently spent the money on them, if I get a lot of splash pages and stuff, I feel, and it reads real fast. I mean, unless I really, really love the art, I feel like, man, I want a little more story than that. But when it comes to Kirby, I don't really, you know, he can do as many splashes as he wants. It's cool with me because they're always so awesome to look at. There's so much detail and, you know. But, we get Superman ends up getting his act back together, and two of them are able to take out the big Jimmy Olsen. And I thought it was kind of funny that the big green giant Jimmy grabs the real Jimmy Olsen and recognizes himself, and it confuses him.
Yeah.
And, but yeah, I think one of the best parts of the episode is when they episode yeah the issue is when they take him out and all these little
scrapper troopers
little mini scrappers come dropped off by miniature planes and start flying down in parachutes and put together a machine to freeze the giant in some kind of a icy steel armor.
What I really liked about it is it wasn't Guardian or Superman that took out Jimmy Olsen. It was these paratroopers.
Yeah.
All of a sudden, gas is coming out of like his ears. They like gas the shit out of him at first. And it's like, awesome because they're little army men. It's like little army men scrappers.
Yeah. Yeah, he definitely... Kirby took this whole DNA replication thing and just really ran with it. I mean, there's doubles of everybody running around. And at first they're like, why the hell is this, what's the gas that's coming out of his hair? What the hell is going on here? And Scrapper's pretty happy to see all his little duplicates.
Yeah.
It's picking up the little Scrapper troopers, ain't they cute? So they use me cell tissues to make these spunky fighting men. Well, it's only a natural choice.
And he's just, like, looking at him in awe. Like, these are cool.
Kirby must have heard that kind of New York accent a lot growing up or something.
Yeah.
He likes to use that.
And Darkseid is telling off Simeon and Makari.
Yeah.
In these issues, I tend to think he's always, like, abusing his people that work for him, like, because they're incompetent or they don't get their job done.
No, totally. There's some really good examples of that in the New Gods, number two.
Yeah,
he doesn't have... That's one of the tough things about being a supervillain, I think. It's hard to get good help. If you find anybody that's good at their job, they're probably trying to kill you.
That's right.
But yeah, I really like
the diagram that showed the project and then zoom away his little map.
Yeah, I was gonna say that's pretty awesome.
Mm-hmm.
Cause that harkens back to the first three issues of Jimmy Olsen, and you didn't really get a sense of the topography of the place, you know. Or if that's not the how things are set up, and this kinda lays it out for you. In a kind of basic way, which is cool. So you get the wild area and everything, zoom way, and all that. So we saw all that in the earlier issues.
They play a part in this series a lot, and it's good to see a map. Although I didn't realize how close they were, because they're like floating over in some kind of weird contraption and able to see everything.
Yeah.
And it looks like it's... True. It looks like a lot of it's separated by height. At least I get the impression of that. It's like the project's at the top, the wild area is somewhere in the middle, and the habitat's below that.
Yeah. Yeah, it's almost kind of a hill. The wild area is almost kind of a hill that goes down or cliffs or something. So it seems like they've... Makari and Simeon has done some more... work with the stuff that they sold. They stole from the other lab. They've got a bunch of eggs that they're watching to see if they're going to hatch. Something else that they did with the human DNA cells that they stole. And basically, what were you going
to say? I said it's bizarre that all of the adults look just like their kids.
Yeah, they really are literally miniature versions of their dads.
But this was like heavily into cloning, and I wonder if that was like a science fiction, I mean, not even a science fiction thing, but if that was like a scientific fact that people were researching back at this time period, like if it was hot in the news or something.
That's what I'm kind of assuming, almost as if, you know, Kirby grasped onto the, it must have been like a new news item that people were talking about a lot or something, and he was imagining the possibilities of it, you know, kind of taking it to the farthest extent. But that's kind of, I guess I'm assuming that.
I liked also how Superman let everybody know how long he's known about this place and has failed to tell anybody about it.
Yeah, he has a lot of knowledge. He really knows what's going on, because that's kind of the rest of the issue, is him breaking it down and showing Jimmy Olsen all of the operations and stuff that they got going on there. But I did like, well, basically what it comes down to, they've got three different classifications of beings that they're making. There's the normals, which are just normal humans, I guess, and then the step-ups, which literally, I guess, are humans with some kind of a step up, and that they have some powers or advantages or something. And I guess the Harrys that we met earlier on, they come from that category of step ups. I love how fascinated Kirby seems to be with hippies in this period, because he's got. The Harrys basically look like hippies, and there's some of them go by in this little car, and they tell Superman not to forget about the Friday night singing that they're having.
Yeah, I think he seems pretty neutral on it, though. Like, I was reading, I don't know why, but I was very into obscure comics in the 70s and stuff, and one of them was Brother Power the Geek. And that thing only lasted like two issues. And what's fascinating about that is the editor hated the idea, and that's why it never really took off. But So I was wondering if the editor hated hippies at the time.
Yeah, that has crossed my mind, because being, you know, Kirby, his generation, I mean, being a World War vet and stuff, you know, he wasn't of the hippie generation, obviously, so... but it doesn't seem like he
has hate towards them, because he created Forever People, and what they are is a bunch of hippie superheroes.
Yeah.
And not only that, but the way he represented, was it the Wild Ones or the, I can't remember what they were when they were in the habitat.
Right.
He didn't represent them bad. He represented them like they have a lot of worth and they're doing a lot of stuff. It's just a different lifestyle.
Yeah, it seems almost more like he was maybe fascinated by him or something.
Yeah, I don't know.
Found him interesting. But, so if I didn't say, the other category is aliens, and Superman introduces Jimmy to a guy named Dubilex, and he's got purple skin, kind of a pronounced forehead, and little yellow horns that come out. And they say that he's called Dubilex because they still don't really know what his powers are. So it's like, kind of a mystery. And I wasn't really sure exactly, because he says that he's from Earth, but Superman also says that he's from a different species. So I wasn't really exactly sure what his origin was supposed to be, but he's basically he's sort of overseeing the research and stuff there. He's in charge of things.
Yeah, and he's a big character in the Catamus world in the future.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
He's even been in the animated Young Justice cartoon, so he's seen TV time.
I've seen all those episodes, I forgot.
And this is his first appearance, so...
Yeah, he almost... I kind of... Especially because the last page of the issue flashes back to Makari and Simeon. He almost seen... I feel like he's the equivalent of them, kind of. Although he's probably more competent than them. But yeah, I mean, that's...
I think they're competent. I really do. I just think they fail because they stole technology they don't quite understand.
Yeah,
and then if you have a boss like Darkseid who's pressuring you,
right?
He's essentially giving them impossible timelines that they can't meet.
That's true.
It's like a real job.
Yeah.
These poor guys. I feel bad for them.
Yeah. They're just trying to make a living.
And after we see, I can't remember if it's Forever People. No, it's New Gods. Like, if you're working for Darkseid and loyal to Darkseid, that doesn't really, even if you're successful in helping them, it might not be to your benefit.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't, Darkseid pretty much is your typical bad guy, or he definitely doesn't have a soft side. He embodies the evil nemesis. He mostly is out for himself.
Yeah, I think Simeon and Makari is kind of like, you know, Frankenstein, Dr. Frankenstein and Igor.
I could see that. Yeah, or they almost seem like, you know, they like doing their work and enjoy doing it and stuff, and that's really what they're focused on, is messing around with being evil scientists and stuff. And Darkseid wants to use them, you know, use them for his purposes. And they're not really focused on what Darkseid wants to accomplish. They're just messing around with their science and stuff. You know, they're like maybe morally ambiguous, but not, you know, evil in the way that Darkseid is evil.
Mm-hmm. And then we forgot the eggs that are hatching seem to have four arms.
Yeah, that's how the issue ends, with those eggs they were looking at earlier, their new experience. And apparently next time we're supposed to watch for the four-arm terror. And that's the end of issue 136.
And then we jump into Forever People number 2, which has an awesome cover.
Yeah.
It's got that photorealistic thing happening in the background. So it looks like you see buildings and such.
I guess that was probably a way to save time.
Yeah.
But I mean, I don't mind it, I guess.
It's a way to save time, but he does it effectively. Like in the last issue, right, when Superman's explaining cloning and DNA molecules, you get some more photorealistic. And you can see images of like human heads and baby heads and fetuses and all kinds of weird things in there. It's so bizarre. But in this case, it looks almost like he merges a bunch of photos together artistically and then draws some stuff in. I don't know. It just looks really weird how he meshes it together.
Yeah, it does have almost a collage effect to it.
Yeah.
It was also used, you know, in the earlier issue when they were traveling on the Zoomway and Jimmy Olsen. And it was kind of that tripped out. I think I compared it to Willy Wonka kind of effect, which that worked too.
Yeah. This cover was always one of my favorites when I bought it. I bought most of his comics during my college years, because that's when I really, even though I got into OMAC when I was a kid, this stuff came like around my college years, so. This is one of my favorite covers, and it's got Mantis, who is like a apocalyptic vampire, a power vampire, I guess he would be, and then Infinity Man on the cover, and then it's got all of the Forever People on the bottom.
Yeah, this time they have all their names, not just Beautiful Dreamers.
Yeah.
Which is cool.
And this has some of my favorite scenes in
man.
I took pictures of them on Twitter.
I saw it's that,
like,
yeah.
There were just some. I was like, I took the first one, and then I'm like, why did I take that one? This one's much better.
Yeah, I was literally laughing out loud reading this issue. It's pretty awesome. Yeah, because the pictures he took were from basically the opening sequence, which we find that now that the Forever People have rescued Beautiful Dreamer, they have caused a huge traffic jam downtown because they got their cycle parked in the middle of an intersection or something, and they're just chilling outside of it. And there's tons of, I guess they're New York.
Yeah.
Just outside. And they're basically like police involved and everything like that.
It's a huge traffic jam because they're in the middle of it. And the bystanders are just making a lot of crazy hippie comments. I guess one guy's like, motorized hippies? How about that? And, who's your duty, officer? Why don't you bust those hippies before they tie you down the whole town?
Yeah, I love that guy. He's like, he must be from Scrapper Jr.'s neighborhood. In the next panel, he's like, yeah, get those hippies up in the air, and maybe they'll cancel out the smog.
And then you have the stereotype about how stinky they are.
Yeah, tells a joke
about a bathtub.
Getting rid of hippies, or figuring out if somebody's a hippie, you show them a bathtub, and if they run away.
Yeah, and then Big Bear just gives him a big bear hug, and curses him and knocks him out.
Yeah, Big Bear loves it. He's having a good time. He loves it. Like, it seems like they're somewhat familiar, because he says this is almost like ancient vaudeville, so it almost seems like they're familiar with some of our history.
Yeah.
And they're from Supertown, but it's almost as if it's the future, and they're enjoying being experiencing like this old technology and this old culture. They're having a good time. They do seem like teenagers in some ways, like that. They're just kind of enjoying. They're there to stop Darkseid, but they're having a good time in the meantime.
And they manage to just phase out. They get their cycle out of there.
Yeah.
And Mantis, it cuts to Mantis, which I really like, because this was really cool, and I really like the art, the way they draw Mantis. He just looks very Kirby-esque.
Yeah.
And because he's got like these bat wings underneath him, and then he's got all the like Kirby tech and the helmet and such. I just like it. Yeah,
Zion's really awesome. The yellow front piece of his helmet is really cool.
He is like a vampire, because he like sleeps in a power pod, and then when he's ready to come out, he comes out. And he seems relatively concerned, because like it sounds like he was on Earth prior, like, and he doesn't like the idea that Darkseid's there to take away everything from him.
Right. This was actually another thing that I cracked up. I found Mantis to be really hilarious, because Darkseid's there and he's commanding them to do stuff. And Mantis pretty much, Darkseid could probably say anything, as long as like Mantis can get back in his pod. He's willing to agree with anything. He's just like, every time Darkseid says anything, he just says, done. Okay, done. Like, do this. Done. Do this. Done.
But reluctantly, it seems like, because he's like, Earth is mine. Mine. I came here first. You have no right.
Yeah. Yeah, he seems to be a little bit of a joke compared to Darkseid. But I like that we get, that page that we're talking about, the portrait of Darkseid up in the top left, the first panel, is very iconic. Just the way that, you know, the bridge of his forehead overshadows his eye sockets, so it's just black. It comes up even more so in New Gods. There's a difference of scale. You know, Kirby's gods are, and Darkseid in particular, in other incarnations, especially the way that they made him in the New 52, to make him seem more imposing, they've used scale a lot more and made him really big and huge and stuff. But here he's kind of just human-sized, you know.
Yeah, yeah. He's the same size as everybody else for the most part.
And it might be by choice.
Over time, you know? he's become more taller and taller and bigger and bigger.
Yeah. I mean, I guess you could say that he's just, a lot of times gods, they take an avatar form or something and they choose to be a certain size. So you guess you could say that that's what he's doing, but it's just interesting, especially later when you see him just chilling in an apartment. But, so yeah, we get back to the Forever People where they've phased two, and they meet a kid named Donnie and his Uncle Willie. Donnie's got, Donnie's walking on crutches, and he thinks that they're aliens or from UFOs or something. Reasonable suspicion, I would say.
It's a weird town that they're in. It looks like it's almost like vacated, but with a small amount of people.
Yeah, I was wondering if I...
It's like a slum area or something.
Yeah, I was wondering if I missed something, because it almost seems like it's a ghost town, but I didn't really get any sense as to why.
No, they didn't give you any sense. It's like part of New York was abandoned or something, and these guys are still left behind running the city or something.
Yeah, because the two of them seem to be the only ones around, and they even say... Uncle Willie's got a gun trained on him. He's freaking out. So Beautiful Dreamer uses her powers to make them seem like normal teenagers to him, and he calms down. And Donnie convinces Uncle to let them shack up in one of the abandoned apartments, and they furnish it with stuff from, you know, whatever happened here. The people that left in a hurry because they left a lot of their stuff behind.
The next few panels, I was really curious if they're trying to make him more like a vampire, but like, can he exist in the daytime? I mean, does he just come out at night, or they make it look like he really is a vampire in those panels there.
Yeah, you're right. When you said that, when you described him that way at the beginning of talking about this issue, that clicked for me. I didn't really think about it, but now looking at this. You know, because you got a panel of a clock striking midnight and cemetery, and it really is evoking a horror kind of feel. So, yeah, I think that's a good way to describe him, because he definitely freaks out later when it's getting close to daytime.
Yeah.
So he must not be able to be out at night, or I mean out in the day. But, so the Forever People, they're furnishing their new apartment. And we get to one of my other favorite things from this issue is, they're watching a TV, and little Donnie's like, "How the hell are you working, getting that to work? It's broken." And so we're introduced to cosmic cartridges.
Yeah, that was pretty badass because I didn't remember that.
It's awesome. Yeah, it's so totally like he gives him LSD or something. Seraphim, the dude that wears the cowboy hat. He gives him one. He's got him in like almost like a bandolier around his hat, and he puts one in Donnie's hand, and we get this panel that just looks like he's totally tripping out. I see everything, and everything moves and makes a kind of beautiful noise. It's like, and Seraphim says, "Harmony is the word, Donnie. You're listening to all there is." It's really like he's having like an acid trip. You know, cosmic cartridges, it's like they look like pills. It's very like it's very very much seems like a druggy experience. It's just kind of funny.
Yeah, they seem to be able to do almost anything. If something didn't work, you can make it work.
Right.
And you can,
yeah, if you got
like,
a lot laying around.
Yeah, it's crazy.
If you got a lot laying around, you know, and you're done getting high, you can fix your television. It's like take it around, do home repairs. We get our battle for the issue. It's pretty much a battle between Infinity Man. Because since they got that TV working, they see that they see news reports that Mantis is wrecking havoc, and So they get together and form Infinity Man again to go after him.
And I think this battle, Mantis pretty much takes Infinity Man out.
Yeah.
He freezes him. Puts mm-hmm. him in an icy cube. And Infinity Man's stuck there. And then Desaad's in there laughing in the background. And I think this is the first appearance of Desaad.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think this is a first appearance. Because Desaad, his big thing is creating fear, and he seems to kind of feed off of fear. And he's basically, we get the sense, or it's almost explicitly said that Darkseid is using Mantis. Basically, he's allowing Mantis to wreck his, to create the destruction that he is, because he wants to up the levels of fear, and he's using Desaad to read that fear and to feed into that fear, because they're still looking, they want to use that fear to sort of identify, they're still looking for the mind that can understand and process the anti-life equation that they're looking for. So that's kind of what's going on here from Darkseid's perspective.
Infinity Man does manage to get out of the cube by disassembling it or restructuring it.
Yeah.
And then he just jumps out and starts flying fighting Mantis again.
Mm-hmm. But doesn't really seem like he went. I mean, it's more that it's that the Mantis decides to take off and go back into his power pod.
Mm-hmm.
Not so much that
he does punch him, and then he blasts him with his infinity beam, whatever that is. And mm-hmm. I don't know what the infinity beam is, but it doesn't seem to have a good effect on Mantis, because he kind of he looks like he's smoldering, and it hits the side of a building.
That's true.
It's like I don't know if he absorbed so much power that he just freaked out, because he's like, I can't control my power, Then he crashes in the side of a building and decides to go back to his pod.
Yeah, he says it sounds like he only has enough power to do that, so maybe the damage that Infinity Man did to him basically results in him getting down to the power level where he's got to get back to his pod, because that's all he's got left is to do that.
But maybe it is daylight, too, because it is, you could see, the horizon is starting to light up again.
Yeah, dawn is breaking. So, and the Forever People kind of break it down as far as the motivations of their... I mean, they're aware of the fact that Mantis is... his goals are just to basically conquer and create destruction, where he'd probably be happy left to his devices without Darkseid around to just terrorize Earth. But Darkseid is out for basically destroying the universe or controlling the entire universe. So, and the last couple of panels we get are of Darkseid and Desaad as standing nearby as Mantis goes back, and that's reinforced there, as well as Darkseid reflects on the fact that Mantis just fights really hard and uses up all his energy, where he compares himself to Silent Stone, waiting and plotting. So, it's cool, because it kind of further defines Darkseid and what his deal is, because Mantis serves as kind of a contrast. And you can see in them the difference. There's, lots of supervillains that might fall on one side or the other, where you have your bruisers that are just kind of create havoc and damage. And then on the other hand, you got guys like Darkseid that are more of the big boss type kind of plotters that have the more lofty goals.
Mm-hmm. And we learn more about the Forever People's powers in here, because we got the cartridges that Seraphine had, and mm-hmm. Beautiful Dreamer able to manipulate what people are seeing anyway.
Yeah.
And being able to have an emotional, I think effect, kind of like Raven's power, you know, on Teen Titans. Some kind of power like that.
Yeah.
Be able to calm somebody down who's got a gun at your head.
Yeah.
And Big Bear just appears to be strong. We haven't seen Moon Rider do much, other than he seems to be their leader somehow.
Yeah, he does seem like the leader.
And Viking is still like, without him, I don't think they'd have the mother box. He seems to carry that everywhere. And
yeah, he's the mother box main dude. And their mother box is the biggest one that we see, really, I guess, so they can all touch it when they turn into Infinity Man.
Well, we do see Orion's mother box in this issue. I think we might have last time, but this is a... In New Gods number 2, we get another awesome cover with like the photo background of Orion. Mm-hmm. Looks like he's in pain or something, getting blasted. And you'll see why in this issue, because he does get blindsided.
Yeah.
But this is a cool another explanation about, you know, Apocalypse and the New Gods, and it's really a cool drawing. Like, he draws the planet really cool, especially Apocalypse.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it kind of gives you, if you missed the first issue, this might give you a little bit of a background that you needed to understand.
The thing I didn't realize too much of, I do want to pick up the Ryan Walt Simonson. I don't know if you heard about those. They were in the 90s or so. That's one series I passed on, and I really am interested to try to get those. I've been picking them up at cons, but they're not easy to find. They're usually in the quarter bins, and you're usually searching for a while. But I've managed to get 4 or 5, but I want to get the whole run. I might just go to my comic shop and just do it.
Yeah, it's been in the kind of the back of my mind to look at some of the ways that these fourth word characters are used. Like, you know, once I'm done with reading all of Kirby's fourth world stuff, to check out some of the ways that they've been used in different miniseries and stuff by other creators.
Oh, you'd like the Simonson one, because his style lends itself to this, like, really good. They have the first arc in trade too. Like, I think it's like the first 6 issues of Orion. That's how I found out about it, as I read the trade. And then I found some singles at some cons.
I could definitely see that with Simonson's style, and he definitely has the love and affinity for mythology.
Yeah.
To kind of pick up some of the ideas here. But yeah, we get another great double page splash, which is New Genesis. Which I just think is really cool. Again, you know, we see again that it's a floating city. In order to leave the actual Earth of the planet untouched and unspoiled by technology, and just a lot of like happy kids and stuff floating around and having a good time.
Yeah, one thing I liked about this drawing is it seems like, If you were to correlate this picture with like a merry-go-round, except it's inverted vertically, and the kids are hanging off the... What are those things they have in the playground? They're like the things you spin around, you could grab onto the bars. God, I can't remember. It's like, I forget what they call them, but it's like a merry-go-round type thing. That's what I think of this thing. And then you got maybe like an older... adult supervising them, and he's floating on like this huge ball of balls.
Yeah, it is kind of a hard image to describe.
Yeah, I love it though.
It's pretty wild. Yeah, it's pretty awesome though. It almost, it's hard, it's, it kind of goes into the crease, but it's almost as if the thing that they're on, actually, do you think that that's the propeller for the the whole city? Because it looks like it's connected, actually.
Yeah, I didn't notice that.
And the way that the perspective, I mean, it looks big, but it's just because the perspective, the city's in the background and that's in the foreground. So I think that's actually, I didn't think that either until I saw that it was connected, but I thought maybe it was just a fun thing that's, but yeah, I think it's actually the propeller.
Yeah, I didn't even awesome. See it connected.
So they just hang out on the propeller for fun.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
It's propelling the city, but they're having a blast hanging off of it. Where most propellers would cut somebody's head off, these guys
right. are. Yeah.
Don't do that at home, kids.
No. Yeah.
High Father's reading off the wall again. And mm-hmm. I like this scene a lot because it's like war follow Orion, and then so like Light Ray is like, hey, I'm ready to go into battle, High Father, and he's like, no, you're not ready, you're too young.
Yeah.
He's like, let me join my friend. No, Light Ray, the time is not yet. It is my command.
Yeah.
But Light Ray just wants to go help Orion because he knows that war's coming, so he's kind of, and it sounds like he's going to send some people, but older people. and he kind of like, it seems like he doesn't want to soil a lot of his people because he knows Orion's already tainted. Do you know what I mean?
Right. Yeah, I do. I was going to say that.
That's what's awesome. It's like, he already knows Orion's a thing of war, and we all know Orion's origin, well, most of us do, but
yeah,
you kind of see what's, they haven't said it explicitly in these books yet. I would imagine it's coming up here really soon, but you can see what they're leading up to.
Right. I think even if you were reading it at the time, he doesn't really hide it. It's pretty, you could probably guess pretty easily. He's hinting at it, even in the last New Gods issue, very heavily that, so yeah, and he High Father says Orion's been fighting monsters from birth, and his reluctance is interesting because you think it could be a mistake, you know, on his part, on the High Father's part, even though he's supposed to be good. He's from New Genesis, which is the good, and Apocalypse is the bad, but it's the sort of thing that often backfires, that kind of reluctance to and this might be jumping a bit, but I mean, Kirby, World War II vet, I mean, that was in hindsight what a lot of people said about Nazi Germany, you know, that they were let go for too long, you know?
Yeah.
They were appeased for too long, but that could be reading into things too much. But that does seem to be the potential of what's going on there somewhat. So this is what I was talking about. So last issue, Orion rescued humans that Darkseid had brought over to Apocalypse and brought them back to Earth, and they go what turns out to be one of the guy's apartments. They all say their names later, and his name is Dave Lincoln. So Darkseid is just hanging out in a chair in Dave Lincoln's apartment. He's sitting in one of his, you know, kitchen table chairs or something. This god from another universe.
And you see somebody hiding behind the door.
Yeah. Yeah, that's Brola.
Yeah, and I was very curious to see if this guy ever appeared again, because he just blasted Orion as soon as he walked in the door with the shock prod.
Yeah.
And he was amazed how he withstood that. Like, he expected that to take him out.
Mm-hmm.
And it didn't. But then he's got fists of bricks. I didn't understand that, if they were actually part of his hand, or I don't know how that, they almost looked like they were attached.
Oh, yeah. You forgot my hand of stone.
Yeah. It's so weird because in one scene, it looks like he's holding that prod, right? Where he mm-hmm. blasts him. And then in another scene, it looks like he's got bricks for hands. Or it looks like they're individual bricks because they're colored differently, but they look like they're part of his hand.
Yeah.
The way they're drawn.
Yeah, I thought at first that maybe it was one of his hands, but you do see when Orion throws him that both of his hands have stone in them or that he's holding the, or whatever's going on there.
And that could be like dialogue, because they make it sound like he's got one hand of stone, right? Instead of hands of stone, he says hand of stone.
Yeah.
So you're thinking, well, maybe he holds one hand that's like a stone and the other hand holds a prod, but then you see him flying, he's got both of them. He pretty much throws him out the window and he's like, Darkseid, please save me.
Yeah, I think he actually throws him through the wall, I think.
Oh yeah, it is through the wall.
Yeah. Sucks for, I guess Dave Lincoln's not getting his security deposit back. But yeah, Darkseid and Brolin take off, basically, disappear, head back to one of their labs. And did you almost feel like, as far as the sequencing of things, that this could take place either at the same time as the Forever People or almost before it in some ways? Because we get a fear machine, which we don't see in Forever People, but Desaad is working on it and creating fear. And this is what I was talking about earlier, where working for Darkseid is not a good idea because they need test subjects to test out the fear machine, and Darkseid just uses some of his own men that are standing around.
He's like, time is short, they're your subjects, and they're like, no master, we're in your service.
Yeah, we don't have time to find so let's just use some of our own people.
And Desaad loves it. I mean, he's like, yeah, I like to torture people. That's what he is. He loves to torture and make people fear.
Yeah, it's kind of like Scarecrow, sort of.
Yeah, except I think he does a little bit more because he likes to torture them. Like, physically torture them.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's like he's got Donna Matrix.
He's got sort of a weird mask, too, that he's wearing.
Yeah, I've never seen that. I didn't realize that.
He looks like, it's basically looks like a purple mummy head with sunglasses on. It's kind of awesome. So back in, back with Orion and the humans, he introduces them to his mother box, and that sounded bad. hey guys, check out my mother box.
Yeah.
But it's small, like the one that Mr. Miracle has. But what it does is he catches them up on a lot of what's going on with Darkseid, and the mother box allows them to actually see what he's talking about rather than just listen to his words. He tells them about Mantis. We get a nice splash page of Mantis. And some other villains. We also get a really cool splash page talking about the wild area are hippies, or as Ryan calls it, a bizarre dropout society. I mean, this totally looks like just, you know, a still from a like Woodstock or something, except for like, you know, there's some weird futuristic bikes and a humongous wooden village behind them, but. I mean, they just look like a bunch of hippies at Woodstock or something.
Mm-hmm.
Which is really cool. But yeah, it basically goes on from there to Orion taking out Desaad's fear machine. So it's like the same thing that they're up to in this issue is what they're doing in the last issue in Forever People.
Yeah, it almost seems like right before.
Yeah, like
you're right. Well, it could be concurrent, but
yeah. But I like that their fear machine is hidden in a billboard, and the beam's coming out of the eye, this big eye on the billboard, and Orion's able to destroy the machine. And again, like you said, Darkseid, like any good arch villain. Boss doesn't deal with failure very well.
He didn't fail. He put a fear machine. It was working.
Yeah.
I mean, how the hell can he anticipate that Orion's going to destroy his fear machine? He didn't fail. The Darkseid had him build a fear machine. He deployed the fear machine. The fear machine was working. Somebody destroyed it. Oh, what could you do? It's out of his control. Yeah. He gets yelled at.
You're a fool, Desaad, blinded by your own mania.
It's cool that he says Orion is an enemy to be respected.
Mm-hmm.
And then he kind of gives some hints there.
Right.
Of why.
Yeah, we get more hints that... because Desaad even criticizes him for yeah, he gives Desaad a hard time and actually praises Orion.
How are these people helpful, though? Like, they're like,
I have no idea.
Let's join the fight. We're here for you, Orion. We're going to help you. But, like, what the hell are they going to do?
The only thing...
Unless they're hiding they really are. Unless they have some part of the anti-life equation in... Darkseid just didn't tap into it.
Yeah, because it seems almost like arbitrary. Because Orion says, "Since you guys were Darkseid's first villains, you're going to be the first ones to stand against him." But I thought I saw something else that implied that they might be involved in the life equation somehow, but I don't know if I...
Might have been last issue.
Yeah.
I think that, well, he had originally captured them because they had he believed they had the anti-life equation, and they were still under... They were still captured when Orion freed them, so maybe they do have something.
Yeah.
But I don't think they could really help. If anything, he has to hide them.
Right. Yeah, so it kind of ends. It's not really a cliffhanger or anything. It just ends with Orion hanging out in the apartment with these humans and them saying that they're scared, but they're willing to help him out. And Orion talking some smack on how he's gonna fight Darkseid and stuff. But we do get a little preview message that the Black Racer is coming. So that's a player in this Fourth World Saga that we haven't seen yet.
Yeah.
So.
We're closing in on, at least we're past the halfway part mark in this book.
Of this one, yeah.
Yeah.
I suppose if we do the entire thing, this will be an ongoing project for a while. But I mean, I'm nowhere close to being sick of it. So.
Yeah. No. Neither am I. So I think we should just keep pressing.
Yeah. I don't think I'll get sick of it anyways. And I like Kevin the mix of talking about something we both read and talking about stuff that we read individually. You know, once we do get there, we could always change it up with something non-Kirby or whatever.
Yeah.
We'll get that. We'll cross that boom tube when we get to it. So I guess next time we got Superman's Pal, Jimmy Olsen 137, Mr. Miracle number 2, and the Forever People number 3. Yeah.
I thought the order was a little strange because I thought Mr. Miracle would be the first one because we didn't get it in these three. Do you know what I mean?
Right, yeah.
So I thought it was weird that it was the second issue.
Yeah. Yeah, it seems like it's kind of interesting how the way that they've been sequenced so far seem to make sense, except for, like I said, New Gods and Forever People number 2 seeming like they could sort of be going concurrently or maybe something like that. But
yeah, and Jimmy Olsen's kind of doing his own thing.
Yeah, kind of a separate issue, but yeah, I like these a lot. I thought they were all, it was a good batch. I think, they all, Forever People is probably the one that had the least amount of plot-wise, but the concepts and the humor made up for that.
Yeah.
So I didn't really notice the lack.
I don't know if it was meant to be funny at the time, but it was damn funny now.
I didn't feel like I was laughing at it, really.
Yeah. You
know? I mean, even with Mantis, you know, obviously it's very clear that Kirby positioned him as a... Maybe his power levels aren't as, you know, around the same as Darkseid's even, but he just doesn't have the ambition, you know? So for him to be a little bit comical in the way that, you know, he's so eager to get back in his pod that he'll just agree to anything that Darkseid says, I think it seems intentional to me, you know, for that to be a little humorous.
Mm-hmm.
And the hippie jokes and stuff. Kirby loved his hippies.
Yeah, he did. So much other works to explore too. I mean,
I know, so much stuff, and they're still collecting new stuff.
Yeah, I think one of the ones I want to tackle, I don't know if you have it or not, but I want to tackle the Devil Dinosaur.
I don't, but
because I've never read that one.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I mean, I've read most of Kirby, like Commandy and OMAC, and I like revisiting it because, God, I don't remember it with the sheer quantity of... I remember the art, and I remember panels in my head, but I don't remember storyline or plot points. Yeah. So this is all new to me, even though I read it, you know, 20 years ago.
Right. Yeah, well, that's long enough to forget a lot of the details. I mean... You know, some stuff you know that you enjoyed and love it enough that you're going to revisit it at some point. But, you know, even if it's a few decades, that gives you enough time to come back to it with fresh eyes, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And some stuff's really worth revisiting that way, you know.
Yeah.
Seeing how you experience it, you know, at this age as opposed to who you were 20 years ago, you know.
Yeah, I remember loving it then, and I think I even... have more appreciation for it now, so.
Yeah, I can, I mean this is my first time reading it, but I can see it's a good time for me to be reading it, I think, because I could see how I might not have appreciated it, or might thought it was too goofy or something, or I don't know what I would have thought exactly, but there's times when I was younger that wouldn't appeal to me as much, so it's a good time for me to be digging into Kirby's stuff. And I think part of it was because I read some of his 60s Marvel stuff and appreciated it because those were characters I were familiar with and I liked seeing their origins and earlier days and stuff of it. But, you know, I don't remember, like, especially like reading early X-Men and stuff like that. Or Fantastic Four. I wasn't blown away by the art at the time that I read it in the same way that I am now, and also looking at, you know, I didn't at the time think to or take the time to investigate and discover that he had gone on and created these other characters at DC later on in his career. You know, I didn't really, and I might have been more focused on the characters than I was on the creators when I went back and looked into the origins of the Marvel heroes I grew up reading, you know?
Right.
But...
All right, do you want to jump into some of your topics that we're going to discuss?
Sure.
All right, the first one was some of our favorite Christmas presents that we've gotten in the past.
Yeah, I thought this would be timely.
Yeah, now that we're in December.
Yeah. Yeah, I had the idea of Halloween costumes, too. We missed Halloween. That's okay.
We can catch that in another one.
Yep. So now, were these pretty easy for you to come up with? Or
They were very easy for me to come up with for when I was a kid.
Yeah.
As time went on, I might have enjoyed them as much, but they had less personal meaning, I guess. I don't know. How could you say that? As I've grown up, some things have become less important.
Right.
But when I was a kid, they were very, very important. And I would look forward to it since like October. I can't remember. We're a decade apart.
Right.
So we'll probably have very different experiences, but it was big in, like, I guess it was October or November. It was probably October when the JCPenney or Sears catalog would come up. Mm-hmm. And they would essentially mail you, like, this huge catalog that looked like previews, except it was, like, three times that size. And it had clothes and all that kind of crap in it. But at the back, it had, like, a toy section.
Yep.
And what my parents would do is say, well, why don't you go back in there and circle what, you know, some ideas that you'd like to have. And that was like, that was awesome in itself. I mean, I like to do that with previews now.
Yeah.
But so it's like Christmas every month. But that's what it was when I was a kid. One time a year, you'd open that thing up and circle things. Some you'd get, some you wouldn't get. But the idea of it was freaking awesome. And, I circled a lot of stuff over the years, so, and I can remember highlights in no particular order, but my very first one when I was a kid is, this is when I was real young, is and I don't even remember circling this, but I remember them distinctively because they were very big, a big toy in the time period, but one year I got a lot of Tonka trucks, and I don't even know if they still make Tonka trucks. But I had, like, two construction trucks, and then my dad was a fireman, so I had this cool fire truck that had a pumper in the back, and you could actually hook the hose up to it, and you could shoot the water at, like, a pretend fire if you wanted to from the contraption on the top of it. And those were the earliest memories I had of, like, of things that I remember getting at Christmas that I spent hours. I can't even imagine how much time I spent playing with them at the time, but I would run toys into the ground as far in that time period.
Nice. Yeah, I don't know if there still are Tonka trucks. I know that they still have, like, construction vehicles, toys, and stuff like that, too.
Yeah, you know, I know.
Bob Builder's big, and
I know that they're still around. I don't know if Tonka is, but one thing Tonka was known for, and I don't think they could get away with it now, is it was made out of metal.
Oh,
it was
a
very hard metal, and I think the toys you see right now are very plastic-oriented, hard plastic.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Back in the day, it was all metal. So, like, if you weren't careful and you fell on a Tonka truck, you could scrape yourself pretty damn bad or hurt yourself. But
and they'd be heavy too.
Oh, they were heavy as hell. I probably got a hernia when I was, God, I must have been 5 or 6, and it was because I'd carry around these Tonka trucks. Probably, I'd carry around my dad's tools and some of the Tonka trucks. I eventually had hernias, but they were heavy. So to get them around, you usually rolled them around. But you could lug them because kids are durable.
Yeah.
Just have.
You're talking about the Sears or JCPenney catalog, and I still in the early 80s, we still would get those. I didn't even think of that when we were doing this, but yeah, you totally brought that back for me because we would get those, like you said, and a few months earlier, and because, I mean, there was no internet or anything like that, you know, you were relying on basically, you might have heard of some stuff in the catalog from commercials on TV during cartoons and stuff. Other than that, I mean, some of the stuff you'd see for the first time, you know. Sorry, I was scratching my throat there. So, yeah, I remember going through the Sears catalog, and you're right, it does remind me of going through the previews catalog nowadays. And I got my DCBS shipment yesterday, and I was sitting there, you know, opening the bags and pulling out my comics and just kind of putting them in piles and stuff like that. And And Kara walked by, was just smiling at me. Because she knew I was just like super. I always get, every time my package comes, I'm like, it's coming this morning, Kara. And I get real excited. And she knows. I'm like, I said the same thing you just said. It's like Christmas once a month.
It is Christmas, except it's for me every week because I get weekly shipments.
Right, yeah.
And the thing I really like about opening my box is I don't remember some of the stuff I ordered. Do you know what mm-hmm. I mean? So it's like, I was like, oh, this is awesome. I don't remember ordering this. So I usually find like two or three things that I don't remember ordering that I'm surprised about.
Yeah, I don't order the same quantity, but I think I get the same experience because I get monthly shipping that, like, you know, I'm slightly out of the loop of the online conversation on, you know, people on Wednesdays getting their comics and stuff. So as a result, at the end of the month, I'm looking back through the whole month of stuff that came out, and I'll be like, oh yeah, I remember people were talking about that on Twitter a few weeks ago. And, you know, I mean, there's some, you know, sometimes I'm out of the loop a little bit I'll be like excited about some big issue, something that happened, and everyone else is like, yeah, we were excited about that 2 weeks ago. but I like it. I mean, it means that I get a big pile of comics all at once and everything. But the other thing you made me think of was I think, you know, the catalogs don't come like they used to. I think that experience isn't had by kids as much as there used to be. But my friend at work was saying that her son, they got a big, not a catalog like the size of the Sears ones, but they got something from Toys R Us with toys and stuff for the holidays in it and stuff. And she had her son do the same thing, circle stuff that he wanted and stuff. But she said he circled pretty much the whole catalog. So I was like,
well, I think I was guilty of that. But yeah. What I would do is prioritize. I'd say, if I can't get anything, but right. I'd really like to have that.
Yeah, it reminded me of people when I was in college, the people that would highlight their whole book basically, like for studying. It was like, you know, if you highlight the whole thing, it really defeats the purpose.
Yeah.
But,
because it depends on how you look at it. You could look at the highlight like, as I've read that, I understand it.
That's true. Yeah.
Or you could look at it like, I think that's important, but then the whole book is important.
Right.
And you shouldn't highlight anything then, because just read everything.
Yeah. 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 It defeats the purpose. That's the way I was looking at it. But, well, the first one I was going to mention was one that I don't remember. I texted my sister yesterday because I knew she was with my mom. And my mom, she has your old phone, basically. You know, I mean, she can text that, but it's like where you have to hit the number keys several times to get the certain letter.
Yeah.
And I think I've gotten two texts from her in my life, and they were both one word and yes, all caps.
No, so. Yes or no.
Yeah. So I think I told her to let me know one time that they got to where they were going on vacation, and the text I got was, "Made it." In all caps. But so I texted my sister and asked her, you know, ask mom if she remembers anything that I got when I was real little that I was into, maybe before I would remember. And she said that the thing that she said was a Chicago Bears stuffed animal. And I still don't remember this. And so this is just kind of conjecture on my part, because I was 6 years old in 85 when the Bears won the Super Bowl and did the whole Super Bowl shuffle and everything.
Refrigerator Perry and
Walter Payton.
McMahon.
And had his sunglasses. He
was those glasses that almost took up his entire face.
Yeah. I mean, they were everywhere, you know.
Yeah.
Like, at that time, I mean, usually championship teams don't sort of fascinate popular culture the way that they did.
Yeah.
So I guess, I don't think I would have been old enough to really be specifically asking for things. So this must have been something that they just decided to get me and I formed an attachment to or whatever. I must have really liked it and carried it around, so I figured I'd mention that one because that was, I don't remember it, and she said that, and I'm like, what the hell are you talking about?
Yeah. I vaguely remember the Tonka trucks, but I do remember the one Christmas I opened up the fire truck.
Yeah, yeah.
I was just so young. It's hard to remember that, what you were fond of past, like, five.
Yeah, I don't really have many memories before being, like, five or so. Like kindergarten years. That's kind of my first memories.
Yeah.
So.
I think my next one was Big Jim's Pack. They were like the G.I. Joe for the time.
Oh, okay.
It ran from like 1972 to 1986, but I think when I got them was like in the mid-70s. But I had the entire pack, at least the major ones. I had Big Jim, and then you could buy all the outfits for him. It was kind of like Action Jackson. You could switch the clothes and get all these little clothes packs. And then I had... the thing that was cool about the Big Jim's pack is they had this weird synthetic skin on the action figures, and it felt soft. And then on the back, you usually had like a push button, and the push button, you'd press it, and it could do like a karate chop or a punch or something like that. And I think Big Jim just did the karate chop, but then I had Dr. Steel. And he was a guy that was bald, and he had a dragon tattoo on his chest, and then a silver hand.
Nice.
And he'd do a karate chop too and break stuff. So he was like the martial artist guy. And then I had Warpath, and I originally found out that Warpath was originally called Chief Tanuka, and I didn't know that. I guess that was in the early release years, so I must have had the second generation when he was like Warpath. But he was like a Native American with a bow and arrow, and he had a huge bow and arrow. It was awesome.
Nice.
And then they had the Whip. He was a guy with like a goatee. He looked like Keith Knudsen, like Brown Arrow kind of, except he was a lot thinner. And he had a black cap and like a black outfit, and then he had like Captain Boomerang. You know, he has boomerangs around across his chest. He used to have.
Yeah.
He used to have this chest piece that would go across his chest diagonally, and inside it'd have three boomerangs, so he could throw boomerangs. And then he came with a whip, and then most famous one I think is Torpedo Fist. He had this arm that was like a torpedo, and if you push the back of his button, it would shoot forward and punch things, but it was awesome. And that one Christmas, I remember getting almost like the whole set, plus I got like the Howler, and which was a pickup truck, and it had a Honda dirt bike on the back, and then I got the Laser Vet, which was like a Corvette, but you could hit a button, and then the hood would turn over, and lasers would show up.
Nice.
So it was pretty awesome. And I still own those today. Yeah. So I still have them in the basement, and they're in really good shape. Those are ones managed to stay with me.
Nice.
Yeah.
Like, I'm hopping my Laser Vet, baby.
I took pictures of them recently. At least it was maybe 4 or 5 years ago, and I'll see if I could dig them up, post them on the what do you call it, our forum. Forum for geeks.
Yeah. Nice. So this is the first one I thought of. I think it's fresh in my memory because I know there's a picture of me holding the box. And again, I was pretty young, but I do remember having this and playing with it. I was big. I didn't listen to like a lot of kids' music, but I was big on Alvin and the Chipmunks. And I had Alvin and the Chipmunks action figures and stuff, and I had an Alvin stuffed animal. And, you know, we used to always listen to their... My childhood was a mix of... We had a mix of cassette tapes and records. It was kind of a transition still. And we had a Chipmunks Christmas album record. And so that there was this playset for the Alvin and Chipmunks figures called the Curtain Call Theater. And in the picture, I'm holding the box in my pajamas with this, like, this huge ass grin on my face. So, and, you know, it came with, it was basically a stage, and you could fold the front clothes so you could pick it up and carry it like a little case. And it came with all three figures for all three of the Chipmunks and their Uncle Harry Chipmunk, which I don't remember that guy, but... but yeah, it had like
was he the guy that used to always yell Alvin?
No, because that, I mean, he was a human and that was
Uncle Harry was a chipmunk.
Yeah, he's a chipmunk, I guess.
I don't remember him.
I sort of vaguely remember that he kind of came around when I think he was maybe one of those uncles that came around because they got famous or something. So I don't know. I forgot all about him until I looked this play set up to try to remember more details about it. So I shouldn't talk like I have any idea.
What was the play set called?
Curtain Call Theater.
Curtain Call Theater.
Yeah. And it had like a wind-up curtain that you could raise and lower, and it had came with props and stuff. So you could like pretend that the chipmunks were putting on different plays. And one of the things I liked most about it was it had a trap door. So you could pull this lever out, and there was a trap door on the stage. You could have the figures fall through it. So I always thought that was cool. I always liked like secret passageways and trap doors and things like that when I was a kid. I thought were cool. So that was a big one for me.
Do you remember roughly the year on that?
It would have been... probably like 86 or 87. I did find it earlier, pictures of it and stuff.
If you send them to me, I'll put them in the show notes.
Yeah, I will. I'll give you, and I think I'll have to look it back up. I'll have to search it again, but I think I found a commercial for it too.
Yeah, any ones that you want me to put in the show, you could just send to me.
Okay, yeah, you've been doing a good job finding them. I like putting on the episode and being surprised by what you managed to find. But yeah, there was a whole line of these figures, and there was, I'm not sure if I had some of these other ones, but there was different vehicles, and the chipmunks were pretty big back then.
Yeah, my next one I think I've already talked about, I think, but was the Mago dolls. One Christmas I got... these ones didn't come out of the Sears catalog, but back in the day there was this little catalog called... the School of Joe Kubert used to draw the images instead of take pictures. They didn't have pictures of the toys. They draw the picture of the toy. Mm-hmm. So there was one year that I ordered or circled a lot of things in the Mago catalog, and the thing that was kind of disappointing with the Mago catalog is I was the kind of kid that didn't... I don't know. I was weird in the fact that most kids say, I want Batman, or I want Superman, or I want Spider-Man, or the Hulk. What I navigated to was those characters I didn't know nothing about. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the times, they sold out of those characters really fast because they didn't make a lot of them. But what the things that I remember fondly, one Christmas I got Thor, and I still have that figure, and it's pretty damn awesome. He has his classical outfit and the hammer.
Nice.
And he had the doll hair, of course. And then I had the Falcon, which was one of my favorite ones to play with because I liked him a lot. At the time I was reading, I would check out, you know, Captain America and the Falcon comic book. And Captain America was another one I got. And then I got a Green Arrow, which I was really happy to get because when at the time, you wouldn't necessarily see a lot of Green Arrow in the cartoons or on the comic book shelf unless you were finding him in a backup story or such. And Shazam and Spider-Man and the Hulk. But I also managed to get the spider car, which is really cool. You could put Spider-Man in it, and you could hit a button, and then like a spider web would pop out the back end. And then I also had the Arrow car, which it would shoot like darts out of the front end of it. So that was another Christmas that I really enjoyed, and I love the Mego dolls to this day. I still love them, and they re-released some of the Mego figures a couple years ago. I don't know if it was Mego or another company, but I also bought a few of them that I found, and I would like to keep getting them if they keep publishing, you know, figures like that.
Yeah, that's pretty. I mean, to me, they look kind of funny because I don't have the nostalgia to them.
they don't look very cool, but now it's not because they look cool or I played with them, because
right.
Well, you got to remember, I didn't come from an action figure era. Before right. Action figures, there were dolls, and that's why I had Big Jim's pack. They were dolls. They were mm-hmm. Barbies for dudes. And so were the Mego dolls. They were Barbies for dudes. And later on, you'll see, as we talk about this, that they turn into action figures as I get older.
Yeah, that's always something that's surprising to me, that I didn't really have an overlap between, you know, like the comics and superhero. And all my action figures were other stuff. I guess for some reason it wasn't. Now it's like nowadays I get superhero action figures, but for some reason I didn't have any when I was a kid. Well, I know I was really into Legos when I was a kid, and I know I got a lot of different Lego sets and stuff like that. And so I was trying to be more specific, so I was looking at pictures of old Lego sets and stuff, and I found one that I know I had and remembered, and that was it was called the Camouflaged Outpost. And this was from the Castle line of Lego sets, and specifically Forestman. And basically it was like this forest based, and it came with six Lego guys. And I found on the Lego website, it said they had 236 parts. Came out in 1987. It also came with a horse and like a little treasure chest that had little gold goblets that went inside of it. But the thing that I really thought was cool about it, again, like the secret passages and stuff like that, that when you finish putting it together, on the one side of the, it looked like this big tree fort, and on the one side it actually had a piece that was hinged so you could lift it up, and it had little like Lego-ish leaves, branches type things that sat on top of it, so it was supposed to look like it had been camouflaged or something, so you could lift that up. And it also had another piece that opened up, and so I was just fascinated with being able to like lift and open and close those, and put the figures inside of it, close it, open it, pull the figures out, you know, and just do that over and over again. But I was always fascinated by Legos and loved sitting and following the directions and, you know, having my dad or my mom help me with some of the tough parts and stuff.
I always had Legos, but I never had the cool sets like mm-hmm. that came out later. It was just like Lego blocks.
The initial ones. Mm-hmm. I thought it was interesting to see that it retailed back in 87, it was $23. So I don't know what the equivalent of that would be. Man.
Need to go get some water.
Yeah, I got some here. Like I said, I ate right before I came on the show, and I put sriracha sauce in my burritos that I made.
What is that? Is it like a Tabasco sauce, or
it's like a chili sauce? It's Asian.
Oh,
so it's hot, but it has a nice flavor to it.
Is it the red sauce?
Yeah, it's like
okay. Red, I think I know what it is.
It has like a rooster on the bottom.
Yeah, I know what it is.
Yeah, so it cleared out all my sinuses, but I guess it's still it's still in process. But anyways, yeah, that was... I didn't... They were expensive. I mean, I guess $23 today is not as much, but whatever the equivalent of that was, because I know Lego sets... This is not as a huge one. It's like a medium-sized set, but I know, like, nowadays if you were going to get, like, say, the... There's, like, you know, they have the DC Legos now, and there's a Batcave set. I think it's close to $100. So.
Yeah, a lot of the Star Wars, like, big ships, they're, like, $100.
Yeah.
I didn't realize how cool Legos were. I guess I never really... I build stuff with them. I like the Erector set better, which was the metal pieces that I told you were dangerous.
Yeah.
Because they really had like mechanical pulleys and stuff. But the Legos are pretty damn cool. Like I was helping my niece put together some of like her Barbie doll Lego set. It was like a barbershop or something. Mm-hmm. And I thought it was pretty fun.
Yeah, I still love the whole aspect of building, and the idea of getting the directions and following those step by step still appeals to me. I'm tempted sometimes to get some.
Yeah. But. So, my next one is there was a company called Tyco. They made, I think they made trains, electronic trains, and they made cars, like race cars. It wasn't like Hot Wheels, because a lot of the Hot Wheels, you couldn't propel. I mean, you'd have to manually propel just by rolling them or shooting them or some kind of contraption to shoot them across the racetrack. Well, Tyco was an electronic playset that had a little dealy on... Each car had this little metallic piece that you stick in the rail and you could race cars. And the thing that was neat about Tyco is you could build various tracks. You could buy various cars. And my dad did this really cool thing where in the garage, he like glued this track together and it would fold up into the wall, and then we could bring it down and play on the racetrack, and you'd have these controllers to, you can vary speed and, you know, hit the brake and all kinds of different things.
Nice.
And we would have races, and it was cool because my friends would bring, they'd buy their Tyco cars, and we'd have series of our cars. My favorite was a 57 Chevy that I used to race because that thing was damn fast.
Nice.
But that was one of my fondest things, is when we got that Tyco track and then mounted it to the wall, and then my friends would come over and play on there and buy their own cars. That was a lot of fun.
That is awesome. That's cool that he made that. I mean, I can remember having friends whose fathers were like good at carpentry or something like that would like actually make something. I always thought that was cool. Well, I have three more, but I'll do two together as quick ones. So there's not a lot to say about these, but one was, you know, I had I think I mentioned this before, I had the Darth Vader collector's case for my Star Wars figures. And apparently this was really common. A lot of people had this. But I always remember really liking it, even sometimes more than the figures, because I just thought it was really cool. It fit 31 figures. And since there was only that many out at the time, it came with self-stick labels. So any figures that you happen to have, you could put the label on the slot where you put the figure. And for some reason, I don't know why, that fascinated me. it's probably the same part of me that feels compelled to keep a spreadsheet of the baseball games I've been to. But and the other one I was going to mention, was cause it's not a lot to say about it other than I just remember having it and loving it, was I had a Knight Rider Power Wheel. And so it was like a Power Wheel that was designed to look like Kit, his car. And that was my main Power Wheel that I had when I was a kid. And I just remember driving it up and down the driveway countless times.
Was that you control it via pedals or what?
Yeah. Okay. Like the Power Wheels, they were, they look like little, you know, little four-wheelers or something like that, except for I think they're three wheels, so like little three-wheelers.
Yeah, I just didn't know if it was motorized or if it was mechanical.
No. Yeah, they were low to the ground, they were mechanical, you pedaled them like a bicycle, but like the pedals were in front of your feet, like you sat down low on them. They were low to the ground. And this one was black, and it had like the red stripe across the front of it, like the car kit did. Yeah, it was pretty awesome. I forgot about that. We were talking about old shows and stuff. That Knight Rider was another one that I used to watch.
Yeah, I watched that a lot too.
Yeah. Sorry, I'm laughing because Luna's coming in and out of the room. So she'll like nudge the door open, come in, come over to me, get petted, and then Carol will come up and like close the door behind her slightly, and then she'll like go over and nudge the door back open to leave the room. So Carol will come and close it, and she keeps doing it. She keeps coming in and out and checking on me.
I think I only have one more, and it was the Star Wars. When I got the Star Wars Death Star, that was pretty damn awesome. Thanks. Death Star had like four levels. It had the garbage compactor. it had this the little area where Luke got across from one area to the other by swinging.
Yeah.
It had the Ben Kenobi top, you know, where he like turned off the power or the tractor beam. So I really liked that Death Star, and I also had the Millennium Falcon. That which I never got that one. I've procured a new one, but I have fond memories of the old one.
Yeah.
And then I had the Star Wars Cantina, which, man, it really wasn't much. It really was just like a bar area. Mm-hmm. And it had a backdrop of like a little cardboard cutoff of the cantina and the characters. And I think it came with two exclusive figures. And it a lot of the Star Wars toys in those days, they had little circles on the bottom of the feet. And you could like do action scenes with them. Like it had levers and dealies so you can like move them around.
Nice.
But those ones I remember quite fondly. I think that was it until we get into the electronic area. We'll save that for another time, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah, it's funny that thinking back, I had as many Star Wars figures, I think, as I did G.I. Joes, but I must be because I was younger when it came to the Star Wars that as far as spending the money on stuff for me and what I wanted, I didn't really... When people talk about like the playsets and the vehicles and stuff from Star Wars, I'm always, that's really awesome. You had the Death Star because I don't really have any memories of Star Wars stuff other than the figures that I had. But looking on, especially looking on YoJo.com, at you know you can look year by year at the different figures and vehicles and stuff that came out. And I did have a lot of G.I. Joe vehicles and stuff. And because I already mentioned I think the last episode or the one before where the mobile command center was one of my favorite toys that I wish I still had. I kind of went with my second favorite Joe vehicle. And I think this came out around the same time. This was the Tomahawk. And they have the Order of Battle books where it shows all the Joe vehicles and equipment and stuff like that. It's described in there as a heavy lift assault, a troop carrier helicopter. So it's like one of those long helicopters that has two propellers on top. And there was seats in the front of it for two figures. And then on the inside, it had the open sides so that like the troops could be deployed and stuff. It had a bunch of seats for more figures, so you could fit a bunch of figures in it. It just came with one. It came with lift ticket, and that was the first time that figure was available. And
what does lift ticket look like? Is he like? It's not the same guy that has a hat, right? Who's that?
What kind of a hat?
A cowboy hat. He flies the one helicopter.
No, at least the original lift ticket, he looks like a, you know, he's got like the pilot, the helicopter pilot helmet, I think. He looks more like that. Looks like, because that was his main deal, was flying this and stuff, I think. But I guess this cost $13 at the time.
Yeah.
I also, I was kind of fascinated by it. I can assure you that I did not put this together by myself. Looking at, they actually have the reproduction of the instructions for it on yojo.com. So looking at those, I was kind of impressed at how that must have been one of my dad's jobs. He was, when we were kids, he usually spent the afternoon putting together shit for us. And I can't imagine I did this one by myself. So, because it had all these propellers and parts, and you know, just had to put all this stuff together. But yeah, after the Mobile Command Center, Tomahawk was my second favorite G.I. Joe vehicle. And that kind of finished up for me. But
I'm done too.
Do you want to call that our middle section? Because I mean,
yeah,
we're at 2 hours. We got a good amount of time out of that.
Sure.
Before we transition, I think my bladder's going to explode if I don't.
All right, let's take a little 5-minute break.
All right, sounds good. Talk to you in a minute.
All right, we're back.
We're back and more comfortable. I think it was Revenge of the Nerds or one of those movies where there's a scene where the whole time the scene's going on, stuff's happening in the scene in the background. It's the guy taking a piss the whole time. It's just going on.
Oh, Booger. Yeah, it was Booger. Wasn't
yeah.
It?
I always think of that when I take over the long one. Oh, Luna's coming. I saw Luna in the hallway. I said, if you want to be on the podcast, just say so. If you want to talk to Harley or something. I can't. She never does it for me, but Kara's dad can make her say hello.
Oh, yeah.
He'll keep repeating it, and eventually she'll go, oh. I'll try to get that on tape sometime.
Yeah, not Harley, but Risa, our first dog, she used to be able to do Mission Impossible with me. So I do the theme for Mission Impossible, do, 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 and she'd start howling with it. It's so hilarious.
Nice. Nice accompaniment.
Yeah. Especially I go, do, 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 and she'd do. She made it sound good.
Nice. Did you make Barb breakfast this morning?
Yeah, I did.
Nice. There you go. I got to give you props. She just accepted my friend request on Facebook. I was like, well, we've done 4 podcasts. I know Mike now. But, well, there you go. I got to give you props there. I had to mention it.
Yeah. Hash browns, eggs, and sausage. And toast. No green chili, though. I wish that was missing.
Yeah.
Green chili or red chili? Like Thanksgiving, man, mashed potatoes with red chili? Oh, my God.
I saw that. That sounds good. I want to try that. I never thought of it.
Yeah, that's like New Mexican gravy.
Nice. Yeah, mashed potatoes, but not with red chili. I told Kara, oh, Mike said that he's having his with red chili. I said, that sounds interesting.
Yeah.
So somehow,
there's like 4 or 5 of us that do that. Everybody else uses the you know, your standard turkey gravy.
Yeah. That's cool.
Once I switched, I never went back. But I'm a huge chili fan. Like, you give me green chili or red chili, and I'm satisfied. As a matter of fact, they opened up a Dion's Pizza here, which is like popular in New Mexico. Like, they have like, I don't know, maybe 10 restaurants in New Mexico.
Uh-huh.
And they just opened it. And through Facebook, God bless them, Barb somehow hooked up, if we gave out flyers and stuff like that, that they'd let us go to the grand opening. And it was awesome because it was open menu. In other words, you order whatever you want. So I had leftovers the next day. It was like a way for them to open the store and train their employees and such. And so we got like a large pizza, large salads, and
I saw a picture of that pizza.
It was delicious. It had green chilies on it. And these chilies are good chilies. Like, there's a couple restaurants in town that I could get green chilies, but I think they're just the canned Ortega or whatever you can get like in the can at the grocery store.
Yeah.
But these ones are really good. They look like roasted chilies. They're delicious.
Nice. Yeah, that was actually one of the old school geek brunches that I listened to. Was
Chorizo.
Yeah. And also Barb came on and was given was telling Heath how to cook chilies.
Oh yeah.
I was playing Kara part of one of the podcasts, like one of the middle sections where we were, you know, talking about really obscure comics. and she said, yeah, it sounds like you guys have known each other a while. And I'm like, well, that's probably because I listen to a bunch of podcasts Mike's done and know all this random shit about him. That So it's weird how that stuff comes up.
Yeah.
But I find it interesting. And I've done that with other podcasts, too. It's interesting. If you don't start listening to it, it's interesting to go back and you get a sense of how to, you know, you hear earlier versions of people get used to as they get used to podcasting.
Yeah, it's weird too, because like if you go back to Geek Brunch especially, you hear a bunch of people that now have their own podcasts.
Mm-hmm.
They're doing their own thing.
Someone, when you guys started having guests on, different people that I realized that I had heard, you know, you guys talking about, or that maybe they're not as active or around as much now, but
yeah,
you know, but you guys know, and like Heath being an example, or it's kind of interesting.
Did you see the Geek Brunch video yet?
No, I haven't.
Don't check that out. You'll at least see what Heath looks like, and you'll see Alan in it, and Eric, and Keith Cuttingham, and who else is in it? Ryan King, Barb's in it.
Nice.
Yeah, it's pretty cool.
It's awesome. It's been, 6 years you've been doing it?
Yeah. That was our first year that we met at Heroes, that me and Heath met in person. Mm-hmm. That was the only time I met him in person, actually.
Oh, okay. That's cool. You have to 2016. You have to do something like your 10-year anniversary. You have to have like a
our own con.
Yeah,
it's con.
you could do some kind of like a crossover event between your different podcasts, like like a story that continues on. To hear the rest of this podcast,
you have to jump to onto DC that. Line.
This podcast continues in DC Noise, episode 220.
Go to the RetroCast to hear the rest of it.
Yeah. It can be like the new Thor, you know, like we'll do the past version of current events in the other podcasts. Anyways.
So you want to talk some random comics?
Yeah, I read some stuff. I got a few things here. Do you want to kick it off, or?
I'll mention an odd one that I read that I found pretty interesting.
Mm-hmm.
It's Adventure Comics 1979, issue number 462. In this time period, Adventure Comics was pretty damn awesome because it was $1, but you got like 64 pages a comic.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe it was 80 pages. I don't remember. I think it's 64 pages. But what you had premiering in that book at this time was Flash, Deadman, Aquaman, Wonder Woman, and Justice Society of America. This is prior to Crisis. So you had the Superman with the gray bands in his hair and the old Bruce Wayne, and his daughter was the Huntress, and she was in there, and Robin, Dick Grayson, was Robin, but he was more like Batman, because Batman at this time was retired because he was married to Catwoman. Catwoman died, and he became commissioner of Gotham City because he didn't want to be Batman anymore after Catwoman died. And what was interesting about this is there was this guy, Bill Jensen, who suddenly had like huge amount of power, took out the whole Justice League, and he just kept demanding, or the Justice Society, excuse me, and he kept, like, he took out Dr. Fate, he took out the Huntress and crew and Jay Garrick and a bunch of them, and he just kept demanding to see Batman or Commissioner Wayne, because Commissioner Wayne framed him for a murder I guess he didn't commit or something like that. At least that's what he claimed. Mm-hmm. And Batman came out of retirement and fought him to the death and actually died. And what was interesting in this, this is like a 10-page story, so this is the death of Earth 2 Batman. And he died, and the interesting part is after his death is that Dick Grayson says, I want to take up the mantle but of Batman. And he went to Helena, you know, Huntress, and said, Can I be Batman? And she actually said no. She said, no, you can't be Batman. Let's leave that with my dad, yeah. So that was a pretty cool story.
Nice.
It was by Paul Levitz, who's still writing comics today, and Joe Staton, who's done a lot of Huntress work over the years, and he did Millennium for the crossover. He used to do E-Man for Charlton and a couple other things. That's what he was popular. That was his own creation.
I know he did some Legion of Superheroes in the early 80s, too.
Yeah, he was pretty popular, and you could still see him at cons today. Like, I saw him at a couple.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm.
I didn't even know if he was around or not.
Yeah.
So did you read the other stories in the issue, or is it just the one?
No, that was just the one that I focused on. Unfortunately, for the Thanksgiving break, I took a stack of new comics to read and didn't get through them at all because my mother-in-law's house is so dark and there's not a lot of light, so it's really hard to read unless I'm outside.
Yeah.
And, I ended up reading a lot on my iPad, and this was one of them that was available on Comixology.
That's cool.
I had bought a long time ago for 99 cents. And these are like fantastic buys because it's 64 pages for 99 cents. But the only drag about it, I didn't know when I bought, it was like 8 of them, I think, is that they were black and white. And that was kind of disappointing because I have a hard time reading the superhero stuff in black and white. It's just a mental thing. But like, if it's like a horror, like House of Mystery or House of Secrets or Phantom Stranger or anything that's like out of the capes and tights type thing,
yeah,
I have no problem reading in black and white. So it's just a weird psychological thing with me.
I don't think you're the only one. I mean, I think they do lend themselves to black and white a little bit better, even if they weren't originally, but I definitely don't have a problem with black and white if it's how it was done originally, but I'm not a huge fan of the like essentials and Showcase Presents unless for the superhero stuff, unless I don't really have another option to get them inexpensively, you know?
Yeah.
But all right, I just want to make sure I didn't cut you off on the rest of those, but well, I haven't totally finished them yet, but I did read a couple more issues of the original Night Force. I read issues 9 and 10, so I got a few more left. These, again, are by Marv Wolfman and Gene Colan. And these two issues finish the story that started out, if you remember, the issue number 8 was half of it was finishing the storyline from issues 1 through 7, and then the second half started a new issue,
mm-hmm.
or a new story. So these two issues finished that story, and it had a very horror anthology feeling to it. And in hindsight, it probably would have been a better idea if they had started out with with shorter stories like this than launching the book with such a long story, knowing that the book had some sales issues and stuff. But the basic gist of the story is that there's a house, or actually rather an apartment building, and it's all the residents are trapped in there by this monster. It kind of reminds me of like a Cthulhu-type outer space kind of alien, very strange. It's not anthropomorphic at all. And its motivation is to test out the humans and to see how complacent they'll be if it gives them... It's basically able to provide anything that they want. So it's testing them to see if they'll resist if they're given everything. And the Baron Winters, sends a guy that's a murderer in, basically because he knows that this guy Paul Brooks isn't going to be able to make it out, so he wants to send somebody to rescue these people that is, that doesn't really care about sacrificing, essentially. That was kind of cracking me up because a lot of the people are in the building have given into this monster and they're pretty docile, but this woman that is still sort of resisting takes this guy Paul in, and her husband is basically just sitting in front of the TV not paying any attention, and so Paul hits on her, tries to make out with her, and he finally gets a reaction out of the husband by doing that, and he gives up a fight for like a minute, and as soon as Paul stands up to him, he's like, whatever, you're probably right. He just sits back down and goes to watch TV. But the monster, when anybody dies in the building, rather than waste the meat as it sees it, eats the humans. And there's this other guy that comes up with a plan to kill the monster. He's like a scientist. He doesn't really reveal the details. He just says that he keeps saying, "We are the weapon. We are the weapon." But he gets killed by the monster, and he has a hypodermic needle on it, and so Paul figures out that he needs to inject himself with it. He gets that far in figuring out what the guy meant by "we are the weapon," but he doesn't really... He injects himself, he's not smart enough to realize that the guy was planning on sacrificing himself. So Paul does take out the monster, but he takes him out by getting eaten by the monster, and the stuff that he injected himself with was poisonous to the monster. So, and the Baron's plan to basically send this guy in, rescue these people, but sort of sacrifice his emissary there, works out. But I thought it was cool. I mean, it's like, it had much more of a, like I said, a horror anthology feel, like the other ones that DC had, like House of Mystery, and where Baron Winters in this case almost acts more like the horror host, like they used Cain and Abel, in the House of Mystery and House of Secrets book. So, we'll never know, but I wonder if people would have latched onto the series a little bit more easily if they had started with little shorter stories like this. So.
How did they portray Vanessa Van Helsing in these issues?
She was in the first story, those first seven issues. She is kind of crazy, or people think that she's crazy because she has that conduit or ability to harness evil or sense evil. Are you asking because she shows up in... the new miniseries that just came out, or
no? I was just curious because she's the only one. if you say Night Force, I only think of Baron Winters and Van Helsing, and Van Helsing I just do from the Dracula.
Right, it's memorable.
Yeah,
because
it's memorable.
That.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I did end up.
She was not in the new series.
Oh yeah, you're right. I think Baron Winters mentions their name because I kept saying that I was going to read all those at once.
Yeah, it was basically just that private eye or the retiring policeman and the one woman that was impregnated with that alien being or whatever from generation to generation.
Yeah. So I finally read the whole miniseries back to back, and I did like it. I agreed with what you said, that it could have been a little bit shorter. But it was good. I mean, one of the other characters, one of the three, forget what his name, but the guy that was the Georgetown professor in the first story, I was surprised to see he actually does show up, and he's the guy that's missing two of his limbs.
Right.
Teleport his hospital bed, and he's real reluctant to associate with the Baron anymore.
Yeah.
So it's kind of cool that there's a continuity. I mean, I think I have like 3 or 4 issues left of this, and I'll probably at some point check out the 90s series too, just to have read all of them. But It's pretty cool.
Nice. Well, I also finished up a series. I finished up Blood Pack number 4. And this series ended up pretty good. It was just a 4-issue miniseries where the producers were an organization of a bunch of rich people, from what I could tell, that were gathering Blood Pack members and also trying to terraform the Earth, or actually destroy it via earthquakes and such. Mm-hmm. And in this issue, Blood Pack is kind of, they know that the producers are bad and they're trying to fight them, and they're actually showing like them doing heroic stuff, but it's not really them. It's like the TV show that they're on. They're saying, so the media thinks that, you know, Blood Pack's pretty awesome, but they're just sitting back watching the TV and saying, how can we put up with this shit? That's not us. You know, like they're falsifying stuff. And they end up going out, fighting the producers. Everybody bails out on there's the lead woman who's running the producers. Everybody bails on her because she's losing a lot of money or something like that. And all the disaster that's happening. And then Jade gets free and they kind of all fight and conquer the producers, and everybody disbands at the end, with the exception of there was a handful of them that stayed behind, and I think it was Nightblade and Ballistic and Jade were the main team, and then Sparks and Mongrel stuck around too. They actually seemed to form like some kind of sexual relationship, even though Mongrel was the one guy that betrayed everybody on the team, and then everything just seemed copacetic right afterwards. The producers convinced him, well, we're doing this with the Blood Pack agents, and you'll be in power. And he said, okay, so he betrayed his best friends and his team so he could work for the producers, and they just let him back on the team.
I keep thinking of the producers, like the play.
Yeah. It was a good story, and it was by a bunch of people I didn't even realize. You know, Charles Moore, Christopher Taylor, and Mark Campos on pencils.
Nice.
It's interesting going through the ads because, let's see, this year was 1995, and AOL was the shit back on then. It was like you could go on to DC Comics Online if you have AOL in forum chats.
I remember when chat rooms debuted.
Yeah,
you didn't have to talk to people on message boards anymore. That was a big change,
right?
And
this
crazy.
Was the year Green Lantern was Parallax, or Hal Jordan was.
Some
weird spreads in this book. Hawkman was that Avatar type creature. He was more God-related or Avatar-related than he was the Carter Hall that we know.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't the alien. It wasn't the archaeologist. At the time, it was written by Messner Loebs and Ron Lim.
I had kind of a gentle introduction to Hawkman because I didn't read any Hawkman until Jeff Johns
rebooted it. One of the best arcs, too.
So I was able to, because, I mean, one of the things that was real cool about that apparently was that he was able to figure out how to synthesize the really convoluted origin of Hawkman.
Mm-hmm.
or even not so much origin, but history. And so I was gently introduced to Hawkman. I had Jeff Johns to lead the way and make everything connected. So, and it was only in hindsight that I realized some of the character's history in publication and how
it's really convoluted.
How many times you'd been rebooted and confused? Yeah.
The ones that you mentioned Hawkman, and the two I always think of as being like the definite Hawkman is the Jeff Johns arc, because he kind of like took all the craziness and made sense out of it. But right. Before that was the Tim Truman run. It was freaking amazing. That's when he made him like really Thanagarian, and most of the series took place on Thanagar. Mm-hmm. It was in that deluxe series, the Hawk World series, and it was awesome.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Well, yeah.
I'm a big Tim Truman fan though too, so.
I don't think I know a lot of his stuff. I don't think I've read much Tim Truman stuff. Would that be your favorite thing that he's done, or what, something else?
Well, I just
stand out to you more than that.
What has he done? He's an artist and writer. Mm-hmm. So in the terms of Hawkman, he did both. But a lot of the he did. I can't remember if it was Grimjack. I think it was Grimjack for like an independent that was really popular.
Oh, okay. And, yeah, I know. I've heard of Grimjack.
I can't remember some of the other stuff he did. Maybe he did Scout. I don't know. He was really big in the independent world.
Yeah.
And he just did for IDW Hawken, which I was pleasantly surprised that I ordered the trade. And I'm looking forward to reading that.
Oh, okay.
He's teamed up with Lansdale on the Jonah Hex Vertigo series, which was really awesome.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Yeah, so, yeah, there's a lot of stuff that he's done that I like.
Yeah,
a lot of independent stuff too.
It's all stuff I've heard of.
He's from the Kirby school.
Yeah, it's like one of those cases where you've heard a lot of the things that he's done, but don't realize it's all by the same person.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of thing, but cool. Well, earlier, a couple hours ago, I said that I was Danny Rand, and that was because I was just feeling kind of into the whole idea of the character Iron Fist. So I went back on with my Marvel Digital Unlimited, and I read his origin, his first appearance, which was Marvel Premiere number 15. It came out in 1974. And it was written by Roy Thomas, penciled by Gil Kane, and inked by Dick Giordano. So one thing I thought was kind of unique about this issue was that it was written in the second person. So the captions are all as if he's talking to Iron Fist, or as if you are Iron Fist. So it's, you know, you don't see second person used a lot. It starts off with Iron Fist being tested by his teachers and stuff. And basically throughout the issue, we keep going from the present to flashing back 10 years earlier. And that flashback, in the flashback sequence, he's climbing Kunlun Mountain with his mom and his dad and this guy named Harold Meacham. Meacham is his dad's business partner, and when there's an opportunity, Meacham betrays his business partner, Mr. Rand. I forget his first name, but basically there's a moment where they almost fall off the mountain, and Meacham, I think he steps on his hand or something like that, and Danny Rand's father falls to his death, and Meacham, it seems, pretty much wants Mr. Rand's life. He immediately tries to the extent of it seems like he wants his wife and Danny. He wants to take their father's place. She's not having it. We flash back to the present, and Iron Fist is going to face his final test, and he's going to fight this giant not guy named Shu Hu. It was S-H-U-H-U. So we go back to the past, and Danny and his mom are trying to survive on the mountain by themselves, and they end up getting chased by wolves. And she sacrifices herself. She throws herself to the wolf pack so that Danny can get away. And he's taken in by residents of the monastery that they were trying to reach originally. It seems like this whole expedition was motivated by Danny's father to reach this Kunlun monastery. And his wife is not even really convinced that it exists, but she is going along with it out of love for her husband. So that basically gives you the origin of how Danny got taken in by these to this monastery, and lets us know how he ends up in this present day circumstances of being trained to become Iron Fist. And the way that he is able to defeat Shu Hu is by harnessing that Iron Fist power that he has for the first time. So you know, it was a neat little story, a neat little origin story, and it's dedicated. I thought it was kind of cool at the end. It's dedicated to Bill Everett, who
Submariner.
yeah. He created Submariner. He's co-creator of Daredevil, and he started his career in the Golden Age and had done a lot of work for Timely Comics. The reason it's dedicated to him is because he died right around the time this came out. He was only actually 55 years old at the time, so.
What did he die of? Did it say?
It didn't say. I think I looked him up on because it was just dedicated to him and said his, you know, credentials. So I went ahead when I was done reading it and looked him up and I want to say heart attack. I think he died suddenly, but let me see. I'm looking him up again. But yeah, it seems like he had returned to comics, returned and done some more work with Namor, but I'm not sure how he passed away. But obviously, it was before his time.
Yeah, it's pretty young.
Yeah. So.
But I guess we're losing a lot of people like that are young, like McDuffie. We lost him. He was really young.
It's always a shame when somebody goes, you know, from something other than old age. Mm-hmm. You know. So. Yeah, I got one more if you want to. If you want to do one.
Sure. Okay, I got one more too. My last one is, because it was so dark, I read a lot of Comixology stuff on my iPad. That it makes like a good thing for when you're reading in the dark. I read a lot of Bloodshot, which I have already read, but Valiant had that sale on, I think it was Black Friday, that said all issues are 99 cents. So it was like all the new issues and all the old issues that they had were 99 cents. So I just went to town and I bought everything that they had. I was like, even though I've quadruple dipped in some cases where I have the trade, I have the comics, I have the new hardcover, and I have the digital now. I don't feel bad doing it. I don't know. It's like, because I love Valiant so much. I really, really hardcore fans. And the character that I said, I was Angelo Mortali. And Bloodshot was a comic that, this is when Valiant was hot, because Bloodshot number one sold like a million copies. That's unheard of in today's standard. A million copies. It's like nine times the best, you know, 10 times the best seller now. But it was written by Kevin Van Hook and Dan Perlin, and he originated. One thing that's Valiant's known for is its tight continuity, and Valiant was known for time. They'd actually put in the caption, oh, this is 1995 or whatever, 96, and this is the month. Sometimes you'd get to that level. And they put out a book called Rye Number Zero. And Rye Number Zero, it was such a bold move because it came out before Bloodshot. But it kind of defined the future of a lot of the universe. It said, this is what's going to happen to the Harbingers. This is what's going to happen to Exo. It was like, it would blow you away if you read it today, because it, and I think it's free on Comixology, at least it was, so it's worth checking out. But it laid out the history all in the future of what happens to these characters, who dies, who's got the mantle of certain characters. And Bloodshot originated from Rye. Rye was in the future, and Rye originated from Bloodshot. So there was an organization that actually captured Angelo Mortelli. He was an asshole too. That was what's cool. Is like, he was a mafia type guy. He worked for this guy, Mr. Camboni, and he was a womanizer. He would be with many women, but was gonna marry Mr. Camboni's daughter because he wanted a position of power. Mm-hmm. And he was not a well likable guy, and he ran into Eternal Warrior a couple times. And one of the things that another mafia organization captured him and gave him to this Project Rising Star, where this Hiroshi Iwatsu kind of injected the nanites in his blood, and the nanites allow him to heal. They allow him to talk to computers. They upped his power level. They changed his pigmentation so it's almost like white. And he has the rising star in the middle of his chest. Mm-hmm. So he's very identifiable, although I think he can use the computer to change his pigmentation a little bit. So that's kind of interesting. Mm-hmm. But he didn't remember who he was, and he was related to the Geomancer, Jeff, who was a little kid that was popular in Unity. If anybody's heard about Valiant, there was a huge crossover when Jim Shooter was around called Unity, which kind of crossed over into all the titles, and Jeff was the kid, Geomancer, who could talk to the Earth and was kind of guiding the heroes. But he actually freed Bloodshot, and when he was freed, then he kind of became a good guy. So, and he started working for kind of like MI, what is it called? And MI6 or whatever they are in London.
I started
working for the service. British intelligence, and working with Eternal Warrior. The first appearance of Ninjak happened, and Ninjak also worked for them. And he would always get his weapons from these guys in white coats. They were called the Weaponeers. And the Weaponeers would say, oh, we'll, if you pay us, we'll design any weapon you want or procure any weapon you want and provide it to you. So they weren't necessarily good guys or bad guys. They were just guys that wanted to make money and were real smart at making money. And there was a Harbinger organization that was targeting them, and they were killing all the Weaponeers, and he was assigned to protect them. And it was really, really cool story. I really like Kevin Van Hook. I follow him on Facebook. He's a really cool guy. I enjoyed this, and the hardcover just came out, and it's got issues 1-8. It doesn't have Bloodshot Zero, which was one of those fancy chromium covers, but I'd recommend getting the hardcover. I can't remember the price I paid for it, but I think it was pretty cheap for 8 issues, and it's got original story. And the one thing Valiant, the new company's doing, is they're reprinting the material, but then as part of a reward, they're giving you some original material. So it's got a new story called The Tablet, written by Kevin Van Hook and Don Perlin in the back, which wasn't published before. So.
Oh, really? I didn't know that. That's cool. Because I've been kind of – I'm getting all the new Valiant stuff.
Oh, yeah.
And I didn't read a lot of Valiant. I remember they were starting to come out towards the end of my first – period of collecting, and I just didn't get a lot of them because, you know, the collector aspect of it I couldn't afford. But so I've been kind of deciding, like, should I pick up these hardcovers they're putting out, should I track down back issues? But Yeah, that's cool that they have, that kind of helps make the decision if they are adding some new content to it. That's really cool.
Yeah, the hardcovers are amazing. I have XO, I have Archer and Armstrong, which is my favorite. I have Bloodshot now and Harbinger. And in the new previews, they're soliciting Ninjak.
So, oh, cool. So how many issues of Bloodshot did you read this time?
I read 14.
Oh, man.
including Zero, so that's 15. And nice. It was an awesome journey to... Because of the series that I remember, like in my head, I guess I had more fond memories of Harbinger, XO, and Archer and Armstrong really stood out for me. And early Magnus and Solar. This one, I remember reading, but I don't remember a lot of it. So it was like reading it again and mm-hmm. learning about it again. So it was really cool.
Yeah.
And I can't believe how tightly coupled the universe was. It was amazing. It was like joining Marvel in 1963 and following along with all the continuity. I guess you could say that with the new 52 now, too. It's all new continuity, so you could follow from issue to issue what's going on and know all the history.
Yeah.
For some people, the new 52 may be doing that for them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it can be a blessing and a curse, you know?
Yeah.
For the even the comic company itself.
The one thing I liked about Valiant, though, is they never broke it. mm-hmm. They kind of started, they reinvented themselves when Acclaima purchased them.
Right.
And we got popular games like all the Turok games that came for the Nintendo and such.
Yeah.
And Shadow Man game. And but then they tanked and then they were in limbo forever because Valiant LLC and Valiant Entertainment were fighting for the rights and they were held up in the courts forever. And finally, Valiant Entertainment has control and now they're pumping out material, so it's awesome.
Yeah, it seems like they're going about it in a smart way.
They're going about it very historically like Valiant did, which is pretty awesome.
Yeah,
Valiant was notorious for keeping their line pretty tight, like 10 issues or less, or maybe 12 issues. But every issue that spawned off from something prior. Like Ninjak spawned out of Bloodshot. And, you know, all the different characters spawned out of other series.
Yeah. So
they were introduced in other series. They became popular in that series. And then they were launched into their own title.
Yeah. It seems to be the right way to do it, even if you're... Even in movies.
I imagine we'll have a Ninjak series soon now that... the hardcover's coming out and stuff, you know, stuff like that.
Yeah. Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised. I didn't know. I haven't looked at... Sometimes previews the first thing I look at when I get my box. Which is kind of funny. I have all these new comics, and the first thing I look at is the catalog to order new stuff.
yeah, I do that too.
But I didn't this time. I actually haven't gotten into too much of it. We were busy yesterday, so I only read, like, two comics. The
interesting thing that I want to point out for previews is Ninjak. That's a pretty awesome for old issues if you want to read the old Ninjak, which mm-hmm. was co-created by Quesada. So you have early Quesada art if you're a fan mm-hmm. of that. Mm-hmm. And they have Jack Kirby, Joe Simon, Fighting American in there. Like some trades of his old work, which I just recently procured some originals. But
yeah.
I'm really interested in getting those.
Nice. My last one was something I picked up Kara and I went to Chicago. It was the first time I'd ever been there a couple months ago because friends of mine moved there, so we had somebody to visit. And They live near a little secondhand bookstore that sells books and stuff for charity, and we walked everywhere we went pretty much, so we passed by it a couple of times, and they had a sign in the window that they had comic books. So that always caught my attention, and I kept eyeing it as we'd walk by. And on the last day we were there, I got some time to go over there and browse, and I ended up picking up a handful of trades I got deals on for decent prices. And one of the things I picked up was the Power of Shazam graphic novel hardcover, the Jerry Ordway one.
Mm-hmm.
I was looking around for something else to read for the show.
They had a hardcover?
Yeah.
Wow, I didn't know that.
Well, and that was kind of what I was doing. I was there for a while because I was sitting there with my Amazon app on my phone looking stuff up to see if it was in print or what the price of it would be compared to the price they were asking for it, you know? And the stuff that I bought was mostly stuff that's not in print right now or they had for a good price comparatively. And so that must have been the case. One of those situations was the case for this, that it's either not in print or the hardcover is, I got it for $7. So that was either not in print or it was cheaper than what I could get it for anywhere else that I could find in a quick search. So this came out in 1994 and it's written and, illustrated by Jerry Ordway. The only thing that he didn't do was the letters. It's his painted style. And this is the graphic novel that introduced the Power of Shazam series in the 90s, which I've not read, but I would like to after reading this. I'm assuming that you're familiar with that.
Yeah, I've read... If this is the mini that spawned it,
yeah.
I read those four issues, and I also read probably 25 issues or so of Power Shazam, but that's one of them that I need to complete my run on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was really awesome. I think one of the things that I've been finding interesting about the New 52 and when it comes to different reboots, there's certain things that seems to be that seem to happen every time that DC decides to do a big change to their universe. Like, there seems to be a number of interesting parallels between the New 52 and the Crisis and Infinite Earths era. Other examples would be that Superman and Wonder Woman have both gotten pretty significant changes made to them, whereas Batman has sort of been left in without being touched as much. And another one is that it seems like Shazam or Captain Marvel's origin gets retold or rebooted. Geoff Johns has been doing that in backups of Justice League. And this is like the second time that that happened after Crisis, because there was another miniseries that came out right around Crisis. And like I said, this one came out in 1994. But it is basically an origin story. And I really, really liked it a lot. I mean, I liked the Jerry Ordway art a lot. Basically, you have it starts off with excavation, an archaeological dig in Egypt at the tomb of Ramses II. And it is
C.C. Beck. Really,
yeah, well, it's C.C. Batson. I think it's meant to be a tribute to C.C. Beck.
Yeah.
But C.C. Batson and Marilyn Batson, the parents of Billy Batson, and they are with Theo Adam on this dig, and they find in the tomb a wall with a bunch of hieroglyphics and stuff, and there's a Shazam lightning bolt, and there's a couple hands that look kind of like they're holding a beetle scarab. And Theo Adam walks up and touches them and is fried by electricity and gets knocked out for a while. And basically he, in that moment, he's kind of possessed. We find out later. There's hieroglyphics on the wall and C.C. Batson reads them, makes out what they say, and they say Shazam. And in saying that, it opens up a room full of all this treasure, including a scarab amulet that Theo Adam, when he wakes up, ends up struggling with Marilyn Batson, fighting with her to get hold of. He's kind of possessed with anger and greed. So a fight ends up breaking out, and Cece and Theo fight, and Theo ends up stabbing and killing Cece, and Marilyn escapes. He chases after her and ends up killing her as well, and her daughter, Mary, Batson's tutor. So we end up going back to Wiz City, and I thought this whole graphic novel kind of has a feel of like a 1950s movie. Theo Adam looks kind of like an old Humphrey Bogart almost. And Wiz City itself has that retro kind of 50s style to it. I thought was really appealing and really cool. Jerry Ordway's art really captures that look. And we finally meet Billy Batson. He's hawking newspapers, and he's approached by a stranger. He almost looks kind of like the Phantom Stranger. You can't see his face. And he takes him into the subways and takes him down to meet into this cavern to meet the wizard Shazam. So I thought it was kind of neat. Like, obviously, you know, the wizard Shazam teaches Billy the magic word Shazam, and he turns into Shazam. And I thought it was cool how he captures the fact that Billy is still a kid and he doesn't understand his powers, you know?
Yeah.
Because he flips out and he kind of attacks the wizard, doesn't really mean to hurt him, but because he's not used to having adult superhuman strength, he ends up choking the guy a little bit and hurting him. And throws a temper tantrum, destroys the wizard's throne and everything. And later on, he shows his inexperience because he's trying to. So later on, Theo Adam is trying to blow up a radio station, and Billy stops him by throwing the dynamite, but the dynamite ends up blowing something else up. And then even more. Amusingly, he's flying and he's talking aloud to himself and says the word Shazam, not thinking, and accidentally transforms himself, so he starts falling. And luckily, he lands on a blimp that's beneath him. But when he transforms himself again, the resulting lightning sets the blimp on fire. So he doesn't really know what the hell he's doing yet. But we get Dr. Savannah, who is a classic Marvel family villain and character that came from Fawcett, the original company of these characters. And he's the guy that financed the archaeological dig, and he's the guy that employs Theo Adam. And Theo Adam gets a hold of the scarab that they found originally, and using the scarab, whereas Billy is able to transform just by saying the word, Theo Adam has to use the scarab to become Black Adam. We get eventually a fight, as to be expected, between Captain Marvel and Black Adam. And that was kind of amusing. I liked that Billy seems to be starting to learn, because he's talking to Black Adam and he says, "The wizard shut. You know who I mean." He's almost going to transform himself accidentally again. But Jerry Ordway really gets across the fact that Captain Marvel is a kid in a grown-up's body. Basically looks just like his father. So, you know, at the end we find out that the man that led Billy down to the wizard in the first place was actually the spirit of his father. And, Billy finds out that it definitely leads into the series, because at the end Billy finds out that his sister Mary Batson is still alive, and he promises his father that he'll go find her, which allows Cece Batson to finally rest in peace and go join his wife in the afterlife. But we also get a final panel of Dr. Savannah, whose building is blown up and everything by this point in the story, we see him on the street looking pissed, so that implies we'll be seeing him again too. And as I said, you know, it's dedicated to C.C. Beck, Bill Parker, and Otto Binder, you know, the creators that had a big hand in these characters and stuff. And overall, just like, you know, say like the Starman series and stuff like that, I found it to be very, had a really nice, had a modern sensibility, using, you know, old characters and old ideas. And I really, I'm glad I picked it up. I'm really impressed with it. I really loved it.
That's awesome. I don't know why I stopped getting it, but I did at one point, probably because 1996 was when I was graduating, so I was cutting back a lot. I was getting close to... In 96, what the hell was happening? No, I was already here. I was probably saving for a house.
Maybe.
That's probably why I stopped.
I want to say it didn't go that... I think it only went into the 30s in issue numbers.
48 issues.
Oh, 48? Okay. Did the creator... I was also... The other thing I was going to say was maybe it had to do with creators, because I think didn't Jerry Ordway towards the end wasn't involved with it anymore or something?
No, he did them all.
Oh. Then I don't know what the hell.
He didn't draw all the issues.
Okay, maybe that was what I was thinking
he
of.
He stayed writing all the issues.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
The artist was like Peter Krause and Mike Manley. Pretty much.
Cool.
So he wrote it.
Right. All the way. That's cool.
All the way to the end, except for 48, the last issue. But, I want to get these. The covers of these are just phenomenal.
Well, I think 48, wasn't that one of the series that was brought back during Blackest Night?
48 does have just a Blackest Night. You're right.
Yeah, like just like Starman number 81.
That's why it had Eric Wallace, so that's why he didn't write it.
Yeah.
47. Yeah, there's a lot of cool covers here. I think Ordway did the covers because it looks like Ordway art.
Hmm. Yeah. Well, that's it for me.
I am liking the new 52 stuff, though. It's so different and dark, but it's a different take.
Well, when I was reading this, I wasn't. I mean, it made the Geoff Johns one not seem as much of a stretch for Billy to be kind of an ass. I mean, he's not an ass, but like, when we meet him here, he's living on the street because his uncle Ebenezer stole his inheritance and kicked him out, basically. And we find out the reason he wasn't with them in Egypt was because he had bad grades. And like I said, I mean, he doesn't seem like an ass or he doesn't seem evil, but he's pretty...
Still has an innocence about him. Whereas
yeah, and he's kind of like petulant. He definitely throws a temper tantrum. He definitely acts like a kid.
I've always found it weird, though, because it seems like every incarnation, even the current one, I haven't seen him... Well, I haven't read a lot of the Golden Age stuff, even though I have a couple of them I need to get into. I'm blown away by my new shop. I mean, the shop I go to, because all the Golden Age stuff he's procured, it's like so damn tempting, man. I just... I have to fight it every time, but... He's got a lot of Marvel Family stuff, and I've always been very interested in it because he was selling more than Superman at the time before they got lawsuit and everything. So, yeah, I would be really interested to see what it was like. Why was it more popular than Superman?
Yeah. It sounded like, I mean, part of it might have been supporting cast. There's a lot of cool characters, you know? I mean, Dr. Zavanna, he was connected to the, what was it called, the Monster Society of Evil.
Yeah, that Monster Society is pretty damn cool.
I haven't read it, but I like the idea of it. I want to sometime.
Yeah. We have Dr. Mind and a bunch of other obscure characters. I can't remember where I saw a bunch of them recently, but it made me want to go find out if they were real or not. I think it was the Brave and the Bold cartoon.
Yeah, Dr. Mind's awesome. He's a little like a worm.
Yeah.
He's awesome. Well, yeah, I think there was a series, and it was one of the ones that was going on around the time of the Deep DC implosion when they canceled all those titles. There was a Monster Society of Evil ongoing. I think it was one of the ones that got canceled.
I think it was Secret Society of Supervillains.
Oh, was it? Okay.
Yeah. That's worth getting if you could find that in hardcover, or if you, it depends if you want the issues or the Secret Society of Supervillains.
Yeah.
It's central's around such a weird character. The hero of the book is Captain Atom. I mean, not Captain Atom, Captain Comet. It centers around the villains. Mm-hmm. It's pretty cool stuff. You'd like it just because it's so obscure and the villains are not... A lot of the villains are not, like, A-list villains.
Yeah. Weird characters and doing weird things.
Yeah.
Wacky people.
All right. Do you want to wrap this one up then?
Yeah, I think this one we can put it in the can.
All right. Could you send me any clips that you want me to put in, like any commercials or whatever?
Yeah, I'll send you a link to that.
As far as the covers, that's easy for me to find. The issues, those are simple.
Yeah. I'll send you a link to that commercial I found for that Alvin and the Chipmunks thing.
Cool.
See if I can dig anything else up, but... This is Geek Brunch Retrocast Episode 4. And you can follow us on Twitter. I am at MythMakingETC. And Mike is at Mike Myers Brunch. Email MythMakingETC@gmail.com. Mike@comicbooknoise.com. Go to GeekBrunchPodcast.com, is that right?
Yep, that's it.
Be one of the thousands of people who leave comments on our thread there. And join the masses, be like your friends and family, and go to the forums for geeks, and join the robust conversation happening there. Check out Forums for Geeks. We have a thread for each episode. If you want to drop some comments, I'd love to hear from anybody about what they're reading in back issues and what they're collecting. Facebook, like Geek Brunch on Facebook. I noticed there's more DC Noise. People like a lot of people. There's a lot of likes on DC Noise and not nearly as many on Geek Brunch. It's like, people on DC Noise need to come over and like Geek Brunch's page.
Yeah, they're more vocal, that's for sure.
I sent gave me Geek Brunch, the Geek Brunch page management options.
Yeah.
And you can click on, you know, see which one of your friends, you know, haven't liked the page. And Daryl Taylor came up. So I sent him a.
And I know suggestion. I know he listens to it.
Oh, I know he does too. Yeah, it's just one of those things that you didn't, and then you just forget about it, you know.
Yeah.
But it's funny. So I sent him a reminder to like the page. So that was me. Just wondering.
You forced him. He said, "Hey, asshole, come and like our page."
Yeah. No, I think we helped him kill terrorists in Black Ops 2 the other day or something like that, he tweeted.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I saw that. We've gotten requests for, like Timmy Thum and Trenchcoat Mafia, who does another podcast, to come on the show, too. Mm. So I've gotten some emails from them.
Cool. Timmy Thum
does Thumcast, and... He often has Trenchcoat on there on his episodes.
Yeah, I've listened to a bunch of Thumcast episodes, and I have heard some with Trenchcoat on there.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm always up for having guests on, because for me, it'll be you know, an opportunity to first talk to people for the first time that I've probably listened to on other shows or who have their own shows or, you know, like that.
Well, I'll see if I can organize something either next time or the following time. So we'll see.
Yeah, it'd be cool.
All right.
Not like we run out of things to talk about with somebody else, but I could probably give them some space.
Yeah. Come up for air for a little bit.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, so, I'll tell them to read the Kirby thing.
Yeah, if they have it or they can. You know, if not then
they can join in on the what do you call it side. The side where we just talk about anything.
And
the questions they can answer too.
Yeah, the pop culture segment and the random issue segment.
Mm-hmm.
Those are the official names.
I think I finished my contest of champions, but I'll get to that next time.
Oh, right. That's what I thought you were going to say when you said you ended up talking about Blood Pact, yeah?
Bloodshot, yeah. Blood Pact and Bloodshot. Everything begins with B. I'm just going through the alphabet in my drawer box.
Yeah, because you talked about adventure before that. So
yeah.
Trying to talk about, you know, I don't know.
Do you have an iPad or no?
Kara has one.
Oh, okay.
That I use sometimes. She doesn't really. I'm gonna start using it more because I keep forgetting that it's in the house because it, you know, it's hers and she had it before we met stuff. And,
yeah.
But she doesn't really use Comixology on it or anything, so I think I might load up Comixology on that. Still looking at it on my iPhone.
it's worth it.
Oh, that reminds me. I was going to ask you, are you familiar at all? Because they're on sale right now, and it's a really good price. Are you familiar at all with publisher is Archaea? It's Secret Histories.
I'm familiar with the publisher. I'm not familiar with the other than have seen it in previews.
Yeah, I mean they have the first two Omnibuy on sale for $6 a piece. All the individual issues are $1, and they're like 50 page issues. So it seemed like a good buy, but I didn't know if it was.
Yeah, I can't tell you on that one.
All right,
I'm actually cutting back because
I'm just
overwhelmed with the content that I have to read still.
Yeah.
But it's good talking to you, and have a good week.
Same here, you too.
Send me any links that you want me to put in the show, and I'll try to get it out tonight if you can.
Oh, okay. Nice. All right, I'll do that after.
If not, I'll wait. I'll do it till Monday or Tuesday. That's fine too.
Okay. All right, sounds good.
All right, talk to you later. Right. Bye-bye, everybody. Bye.
Bye.
My deal's new Chipmunks Curtain Call Theater. Some assembly required. Runabout Sun and an Alvin Up for Action sold separately.
The Chipmunks at sea. Simon's a pirate. Look out, Simon. Uh-oh, a shark. Alvin to the rescue.
Cowboys don't go on pirate ships.
The Chipmunks Curtain Call Theater comes with lots of props and backdrops. Chipmunk figures sold separately. New from Ideals.
The world's greatest superheroes. Batman and Robin, the dynamic duo. Superman, the Man of Steel. Aquaman, the famous undersea crime fighter. Tarzan of the Apes. Shazam, now featured on network television. Captain America, fighting injustice the world over. Spider-Man, the weird wall climber. The Super Foes, the archenemies of the superheroes. The Super Gals, Wonder Woman, Supergirl, Batgirl, and Catwoman. The Green Arrow, crime fighter from the forest. Iron Man, power personified. The Falcon, that great black superhero. The Green Goblin, Spider-Man's strange enemy. The Lizard, half-man, half-beast. And the fantastic green giant superhero, the Hulk. And for 1976, the Fantastic Four, the Torch.